It's time for the Scott Rintoul Show.
He holds, he shoots, he scores!
Where the West...
Pettersson up the left wing, steps into a slap shot and scores. Elias Pettersson, oh my word, again.
...is one.
Rebound, Kachuk scores! What a night for Matthew Kachuk.
Let's make it happen. Everything you got, no excuses.
Jackson avoids, spins, he's in. Touchdown, McCaffrey leaps.
Now, here's Scott Rintoul.
Pull my trigger, let me blow your mind.
What's going on? How's your Thursday? Scott Rintoul with you. Thanks for joining us. We'll make it better. That's our pledge to you every single day, and we will do it again today as we get ready for one of the more underappreciated players, perhaps, in the National Hockey League, kicking off his Western Canadian road swing. Is that fair to say? About Jack Eichel? We'll have that conversation in just a couple of minutes. You can nominate another player. Usually it's someone from the other conference. You don't see them as often. You don't have as great of an appreciation. I know that we get a lot of Eastern media, and I know that specifically with Canadian markets, you get inundated with specific highlight packages and stories on certain talents in the National Hockey League. But guys who might play in a market that is undercovered by Canadian sources, usually an Eastern market, as mentioned, that you don't see as often. The games are a little earlier. Maybe you're not home from work yet. Is Jack Eichel that guy for you? I know who it used to be. I don't think it's that guy anymore, but we'll talk about it here in just a couple of minutes' time. We're going to switch a couple of things around this morning because we've got a stacked-up guest list. Offensive lineman with the Kansas City Chiefs, Laurent Duvernay-Tardif. He is going to join us next hour, so we'll move what they're saying into this hour. We'll get into that conversation a little later on, but Laurent Duvernay-Tardif will join us. Offensive lineman, as mentioned, with the Kansas City Chiefs. You may know of his reputation. He's a doctor as well. Not bad. He's got career options. Things are working out okay for LDT as he gets set for the Patriots this weekend. He and the Chiefs head into Gillette Stadium. Third time these two teams are going to meet in the last couple of years. Had the playoff meeting that went to overtime. Is there a feeling of payback? How is it different this time around? Things we will talk about with Laurent Duvernay-Tardif. And I will also have the conversation about the final frontier, at least in this continent, for Canadian athletes. At least that's the way it feels, and we might break it. Might start to crack through it this coming year. That's an hour from now. In the here and now, we're talking about Jack Eichel coming to Western Canada. And is he the most underappreciated guy to you right now among very good or great players in this game? Jack Eichel's seventh in lead scoring. In league scoring, I should say. He's had a great year once again, but he plays in a depressed market for a Buffalo Sabres team that has been awful for his entire existence. Looked like they were going to be okay last year. Looked like things were just going to be fine. They had the 10-game winning streak, and then it all fell apart. Well, the start to the season was great. They've come back down to earth, and they roll into Western Canada 13-10-5 right now, sitting eighth in the conference. Jack Eichel, is he the most underappreciated player? The guy who used to hold that, and I don't think does anymore, I know his name always comes up as far as underappreciated, underpublicized. Greatest player out there that nobody talks about is Alex Barkov. I think we got past that last year. It took that long, and maybe it shouldn't have, but Alex Barkov won himself a Selke last year. Or pardon me, it was the Lady Bing he won last year. Ryan O'Reilly got the Selke. He got himself the Lady Bing. He had 96 points. Everybody had that conversation so often that if you happen to be the most underrated player and that gets talked about for long enough, well, you can't be the most underrated player anymore because now everybody's talking about you. Alex Barkov, to me, has crossed that threshold. We now look at him as one of the best players in the game, one of the best two-way players, certainly, among centers in the National Hockey League. Maybe it's Jack Eichel for you. Maybe it's still Artemi Panarin. Panarin's off to a great start this year. Again, maybe a guy who passed over the same way that Alex Barkov did last season. It does feel like the last couple of playoffs, we've taken more notice of Panarin, certainly the Blue Jackets with the sweep of the Lightning last year caught a lot of attention. And maybe it's because he did his thing the past two postseasons that he has crossed that threshold as well. But a guy that I thought we'd be talking about a little more, maybe it's because the Rangers haven't been great, but he's been great. He's been great recently. Panarin's been excellent. So does he qualify for that for you? Or is it a teammate of a guy I just mentioned? A guy who's kind of in the same category as Eichel, for me, is Jonathan Huberdeau. Huberdeau, again, another really good year. Unlike Eichel, not really overshadowed by a teammate. Eichel is kind of the first guy you think of when you think of the Buffalo Sabres, but when you think of the Florida Panthers, it will be Barkov at the top of the list. And we know they got the big-name goalie now, even though he hasn't played up to expectation for most of this season. But Jonathan Huberdeau has 33 points. He's got the same number as Artemi Panarin so far. He is 10th in league scoring entering play tonight. Who is the most underrated slash underappreciated player in the National Hockey League? Usually for us in Western Canada, that's going to be somebody from the East, or maybe it's somebody that you think out here doesn't get enough national recognition. Feel free to nominate whoever you want. We'll take your text messages. You've got the inbox. You've got the fan feedback line. Hit us up. Just got this one out in coming in from Calgary. Someone says Claude Giroux. Is Claude Giroux underappreciated? Or is it almost as though, well, underappreciated, I can hear that. I don't know if he's the most underrated player in the league. I think we've had a lot of time for Claude Giroux for a lot of years. And maybe it's fatigue. Sometimes you're looking for the next best thing. Well, who's the next guy? Who's the next Elias Pettersson that's coming onto the scene? Who's the next Cale Makar? And because we're always looking to the youth, maybe that's why Claude Giroux gets overlooked to a certain degree. Sebastian Aho. I feel like Aho's gotten his due over the last year. Maybe it's because we paid more attention to Carolina in the playoffs. Maybe it's because he had the offer sheet in the summer and people went, yeah, you got to pay that guy. And geez, I thought he would have signed an offer sheet for more. That's not a bad deal for Carolina. I feel like Aho over the last year has gotten a lot more respect than certainly he did earlier. For me, he falls into the Alex Barkov category. But I understand the reason you put that forward. Hit us up. You've got the numbers. We'll continue to go down that road. The guy who somebody just texted in, and please feel free to sign your text. I want to give you credit. Is a guy I was about to talk about. And I don't think he is underrated right now because we've talked about him a lot. We went through a little lull. I mentioned him again yesterday. And then what did he do? He delivered in an even greater capacity last night. John Carlson. Yesterday I was giving you the numbers on John Carlson getting to 40 points in 30 games. There's only two other guys in NHL history who have done that. Bobby Orr and Al MacInnis. Bobby Orr did it five times. John Carlson's got a ways to go to match that. But what does he do last night? He goes out in L.A. and he scores two goals. And one of them was great. Man, just really nice mitts around the net. So Carlson gets two more goals last night. John Carlson has 42 points. I want to put that in perspective with you. He has 42 points in 30 games this season. They have eight games left before Christmas. It's very conceivable that John Carlson has 50 points before we get to Christmas, before we have the 2 or 3 day break, whichever NHL team gets. 50 points for a defenseman by Christmas. Maybe you don't realize how special that is. So let me give you a couple of other stats here. He is already halfway to beating the most points we have seen this century by a defenseman. Brent Burns had 83 last year. That's the most points any blue liner has had since 2000, since the old Y2K. That's the most points anyone has had. John Carlson is more than halfway there, and he's played 30 games. The last defenseman in this league to score 90 or more points. Can you name that guy? It's been a while. I will certainly forgive you if it doesn't pop to top of mind. It's Ray Bourque. Feels like Ray Bourque has been retired forever. Ray Bourque is the last defenseman in this league to hit 90 points. He did it in 93-94, before the first lockout. The one that was before the season in its entirety. The one back in 94-95. Ray Bourque put those point totals up then. We haven't seen a defenseman get to 90 points, and Carlson's got a long way to go, and we know the pace is probably going to slow down, but 42 points in 30 games, The same way we're talking about McDavid and Draisaitl taking a serious run at 140 points, we have to have that conversation about John Carlson. Jamie, you brought up a great point. You brought up a great point. Everybody keeps mentioning this guy's name. They should mention his name, and he's likely going to win a major award this year. But even his teammate last night went on record as saying it should be two trophies. Who is that?
Cale Makar. So, yeah, Cale Makar is the front runner for the Calder. There's no doubt about that. And we love what Quinn Hughes is doing here in Vancouver. Maybe he makes it a race. But right now it's Cale Makar's award to lose. But I've heard people on this station, and then as you alluded to, Nathan MacKinnon, after they beat the Leafs last night, went out and said, yeah, he shouldn't just be winning the Calder. He should be winning the Norris. Now, I get it. Guys pump up their teammates. I'm not burying MacKinnon here. But I've heard many people say, oh, Makar should be in the running for the Norris. John Carlson is winning the Norris. If he keeps anything close to this up, it's going to be unanimous, or at least it certainly should be. So I love what Makar's doing, but no, John Carlson is going to win the Norris.
Yeah, and there's a different distinction between, hey, he's in the running, he's in the conversation. Yeah, sure, I can put Cale Makar in that, but he's not the front runner. Not the front runner at all. He's 15 points behind John Carlson. Now, he's played three fewer games, but 15 points is a lot. And this man has 42 points in 30 games so far this year.
And John Carlson is not a one-dimensional defenseman either. And, you know, I think sometimes that charge is a little overstated with guys like Makar or Erik Karlsson, but, like, John Carlson is a number one every situation defenseman. And he's putting up points like this.
Now, I wouldn't put Nathan MacKinnon in the take the L conversation for that opinion. I wouldn't put him there. By the way, we do this every Thursday. Who needs to take the L in sports? Is there somebody this week that you say, dude, take the L, stand down, enough already? We're going to get to that in just a couple minutes' time. We want you to nominate people for that. I understand him saying Cale Makar has been great. Guys pump up their teammates. Richard Sherman is famous for this in the National Football League. Your point about John Carlson is a very good one. When they won the Stanley Cup, Carlson was going to go to free agency and he signs the big deal, gets $8 million. The thought at the time was, ooh, is he an $8 million defenseman? That's looking like a pretty good bargain right now.
Not bad.
That is looking like a massive bargain right now for John Carlson. He might reach 50 points by Christmas. That is mind-boggling to me. As mentioned, they play 8 more games. He needs 8 points. I want to really put this in perspective for one market here in particular. 50 points, maybe that doesn't seem like a lot to you. Maybe if you're in Calgary and you just watched Mark Giordano put up 74 points last season and win the Norris, and you've seen guys like Dennis Weidman eclipse 50 points. He had 56 one year with the Flames. Maybe 50 points doesn't sound like a lot. But in Vancouver, that's a lot. That's a big threshold. Since the turn of the century, the Canucks have had exactly one defenseman reach 50 points. One. And he didn't go beyond 50 points. He hit 50 points on the nose, and he got paid for it. The Canucks didn't pay him. They let somebody else do that. In fact, it's the somebody else who rolls into Calgary tonight and is going to roll into Rogers Arena on Saturday. The Buffalo Sabres paid Christian Ehrhoff a lot of money, gave him a 10-year deal because he put up 50 points with the Canucks on that blue line. That's the most a Canucks blue liner has had this century. And John Carlson might get it by Christmas. Now, Quinn Hughes is probably going to eclipse that mark as well this year. He's had a great season. He's probably going to have some sort of rookie wall or rookie slowdown at some point in time. But chance of him getting to 50 with what he's done at the start of this season, that looks pretty good. So it's not just what's happening in Washington. This is the new era of defensemen, the new mobile defensemen. It's the rules right now. It's the fact that young players can have a greater impact. Quinn Hughes is playing power play time. He's playing power play one in Vancouver. There's not a lot of rookies that get afforded that opportunity. But think of that, that John Carlson is going to go home and unwrap presents, and he may have as many points as any Canuck defenseman has had since the turn of the century in an entire season. That is remarkable stuff. John Carlson already, like, if you want to compare him to the Canucks, John Carlson has 8 more points than any Canuck defenseman had last season. All of last season. Alex Edler was their leading point getter. He had 34. Carlson has 42 already. He's been remarkable. Send in your submissions. Who do you think is the most underrated player? Someone said Nathan MacKinnon. I can't count Nathan MacKinnon as underrated anymore. He was second in Hart Trophy nomination. Some people call him the second best player in the league behind Connor McDavid. He is a draw. I can't put Nathan MacKinnon in that conversation. Braden Point. I feel like Braden Point gets his. But maybe, I mean, this is a 40-goal guy from last year. Braden Point, yeah, he's a little bit overshadowed by Nikita Kucherov, so I can see the comparison to a Huberdeau. I'll take that one. I can't put MacKinnon there, though. Someone said Malkin. Brent from Vic City says Malkin. I've never heard it called Vic City before. Malkin always overshadowed by Crosby, but when Sid is out, Malkin lights it up. He was the guy on a team. We'd talk about him more. Yeah, we probably would talk about him more. I think we all laughed and continued to mock those who put together the greatest players in NHL history, the top 100, and Malkin wasn't on it. And so everybody calls him 101 because it's ridiculous he was not in the top 100. Keep sending them in. We'll talk about them throughout the course of the morning, but let's get to Take the L. We do this every single Thursday.
But sometimes you gotta take a loss and have people rub it in your face before you get made pissed off. And keep plugging, it's your only outlet and your only outfit.
All right, time for Take the L. Send them in if you've got them. I'm gonna start with this. NBA referees need to take an L this week. We talked yesterday about a basket that actually went through the hoop, went through the net, but because the ball spun back and bounced, they didn't count the basket. That's tough. That's a bad look for the NBA referees. I know it was fast, but there has to be a way to correct that. And maybe it's the guys on the court who wear it a little bit. That's on the league as much as it's on the referees. But last night, the Lakers and the Jazz, did you see what happened in that game? LeBron James walking up the court. I get it. Star players get a little more respect. They get foul calls that nobody else would get. I'm down with that. I'm fine with that. I want to see the best players play. I'm okay with some star calls. I'm not okay with what I saw last night. Nobody's okay with what they saw last night. LeBron James walked the ball up the court, as he's wont to do. And just after he got over the midcourt line, over the halfway line, you want to know what LeBron James did? He put his left hand under the ball, and he just carried it for three steps. I'm not talking he was going at speed, and they, we'll give him one extra step because then on breakaways going in for a contested dunk. LeBron James walked the ball up the court, put his hand underneath it, took three steps, and then just started dribbling again. I don't even know which member of the Jazz who was guarding him was going nuts at the referee, saying, what just happened here? That is textbook traveling. You watch the highlight, it is laughable. It is laughable. We joke a lot about, they get away with traveling in the NBA. If you can get away with that, I'm not sure why you can't just put the ball under your arm, walk it up the court, and start play whenever you want. That's how blatant this was last night.
It's good to be the king.
It's really good to be the king. Really good to be the king. I like LeBron James, sometimes to a fault. I have been a LeBron James apologist over the years. I cannot defend that last night.
And the mics caught him up talking to the ref like in the second half after that, saying like, yeah, that's one of the worst ones I've ever done. He knew it. He was like, oh, wow, that was bad.
It was really bad. NBA refs, take an L. It hasn't been a great week for you. That was not a great look last night. Take an L, NBA referees. Nav from Surrey, take the L, 49ers radio analyst Tim Ryan. Yep, and he's going to. He's going to get suspended for a game. Tim Ryan, and Nav points this out in his text, he said Lamar Jackson's dark skin helped him disguise the football when he runs fake handoffs. Tim Ryan went on radio in San Francisco on Monday and said something to the effect, and it's a little more, he detailed a little more than that. He basically said, well, in those conditions with those dark jerseys, and again, I'm paraphrasing what Tim Ryan said here, and his dark skin, you couldn't tell where the football was at that mesh point because they run that read option. And he decided to throw Lamar Jackson's skin color in. It so off base. Just so off base.
Just so weird.
And so the 49ers have suspended him for a game. They've suspended him for a game. It's not a good look. They've apologized to the Ravens. They have announced who's going to be their color analyst on the weekend. A poor term to apply to said position right now because of the way this went down. But yeah, that's a good one. Yeah, Tim Ryan can take the L. Ken Holland take an L? That's from Allie in Calgary. Is that because of the loss last night or because of what happened in Detroit? You're going to have to explain that further, Allie. Thank you, Ottawa Senators, from the rest of the West. How is that on the final game of a three-game swing through Western Canada that the game you win is the final one, back-to-back nights for the Senators, they had to travel, and they beat the front-running Oilers 5-2. Not a great night in goal for the Edmonton Oilers last night, but the rest of the West will take the gift. The other guy I've got for take the L this week is Antonio Brown. Did you see what he did earlier this week? I had somebody text in yesterday. We're having the conversation in hockey, and it continues, and it's about coaching and players and the relationships and positive, effective communication and the way to challenge players that isn't going down the road of physical abuse or potentially verbal abuse. So we're having that conversation right now, and somebody texted and said, hey, look, on the Bill Peters front, if a player had, you know, been racist, if a player had done something ultra derogatory, would the player just pick up and resume his career? We know that would happen. Antonio Brown is a pretty good example of there's a line you can cross as a player, and it doesn't matter how talented you are, you're not going to get work. Antonio Brown is physically still one of the best players in football. He is still one of the best receivers in the game. No question in my mind. He's that good. But Antonio Brown takes the L this week for, again, social media use. So he tweets out or Instagrammed out, I can't even remember which platform it was, on Monday or Sunday night. He watched the Patriots, and he did this somewhat comical, kind of made you smile, "All I Want for Christmas Is You," the Mariah Carey song. He put Antonio Brown highlights to that and basically said, "Patriots, look at what's going on with your offense. Let's make this happen." That was kind of clever. You know what he did the very next day? On Instagram, he goes on the very next day and he goes on a rant against the Patriots, against Robert Kraft, and starts talking about Kraft having fingers in places he shouldn't in saunas, in bathhouses. How can you employ that guy right now? You can't, which is why he doesn't have work. And he is ultra talented. Take the L for continuing to use social media in the way you do. He needs help. He needs to talk to somebody. I hope that's happening. But when I see things like this, I don't have a lot of sense that he is. Take the L, get some help, put the L in help, Antonio Brown. Please talk to somebody. You should be seeing a therapist at minimum right now. You have more submissions, send them in. You're sending me stuff on underrated players. Number one defenseman, that might be the hardest thing to find in hockey. I know what the hardest player to find in all of sports is, and we'll talk about it next and why a guy you think should be gone might be staying. That's coming up on the Scott Rintoul Show.
Now more of the Scott Rintoul Show.
Baby, be my fire. It remains the most difficult player to find in sports, and you probably know the player I'm talking about. Scott Rintoul with you. Thanks for joining us here this morning. The player is, of course, the quarterback. It's not easy to find a top-flight goalie. It's not easy to find a number one defenseman, but it's still tougher to find a franchise quarterback. There just aren't many of them around. Certainly not many of the top-tier guys, and that's why you see guys stick around when you might have convinced yourself by watching them, I don't know if we can win a Super Bowl with that guy. I'm not sure if that guy can take my team to the promised land. Now, I think that people don't realize how many guys, how deep the field is that can win a Super Bowl, as opposed to the guys who will will their team to a Super Bowl, who are just so talented that they can take what would be perceived as inferior talent at other positions and get them there. I think that the margin for error with those guys is so much greater at other positions. And then there are certain quarterbacks that you say, okay, I can build a case for that guy to win a Super Bowl if we put all of these things around that person. We've seen guys do it before. It doesn't happen all the time. Usually it's those top-tier guys that get it, but I understand the case. Which brings us to Jameis Winston, and I'm not making any Super Bowl argument for Jameis Winston right now, but Jameis Winston has been in Tampa Bay for almost five full seasons. He was drafted number one overall. Hat tip right here to a guy that I've had on the show before and will have on again, Benjamin Albright. Works out of Denver. does a lot of quarterback rankings, and I can remember having Benjamin Albright on prior to that draft when at the top of it, it's Winston, it's Mariota, who's going one, who's going two, all these guys are going to lead their franchises. And Albright came on at the time and he said, look, I know why these guys are getting drafted. I know how hard it is to find quarterbacks, but I've run the numbers. I've done the projections. I look at the tape, and these guys, to me, they ceiling out at, in the case of Jameis Winston, if it all goes well, it's going to be pretty much like Jay Cutler. Go look at the numbers of Jay Cutler's first five seasons and Winston's first five seasons. Eerily similar. Eerily similar as far as the yards, the touchdowns, the interceptions. And Marcus Mariota, he's been hurt more, but kind of Alex Smith is where he's landed, isn't it? Smith may have thrown more interceptions early in his career than Mariota, but he was also asked to do a little bit more. Those were pretty decent projections, but I digress. Back to Jameis Winston. 5 years in, that's when you kind of have to make a decision on a quarterback. Do you lock him up long-term? You can go with the short-term plan. That's kind of what Washington did by franchising Kirk Cousins a couple of times there before they let him go to the market. So they can do that with Jameis Winston. Bruce Arians, the head coach, he's had Jameis's back a lot of different times this year. He was asked yesterday, is he the guy for this team? Is he the quarterback going forward? Have a look.
I'm going to pass on that one. I'm going to wait till the end of December. And there's been really, really, really good, and there's some been really, really bad. And, you know, I'm just going to pass until it's over. And then we'll make a decision.
That's pretty honest, and it's pretty fair. There's been a lot of really, really good. There's been a lot of really, really, really bad. Jameis Winston has 22 touchdown passes. There aren't a lot of guys who have more than 20 already this year. He's also thrown 20 interceptions, which is the most in the league, and it's the most by five. Now, they're not all his fault. Sometimes it's been circumstance, but that circumstance seems to follow Jameis Winston around. He's also, I believe, second in fumbles this year. He's second in most sacks this year. So to the outsider looking at Jameis Winston, why are you keeping this guy? What do you mean? We'll decide on that after the year. You're 5 years in. Is that not enough evidence? Jason LaCanfora, he's a regular on Sportsnet 960 in Calgary. He was on again with the morning guys today and had this to say about the future of Jameis Winston in Tampa Bay.
At this stage of his career and his life and with everything that he's overcome, cancer multiple times, all that, you know, I don't think that Bruce Allen is real excited about, you know, drafting some quarterback in the late first round or the second day of the draft and seeing what he can do. I think he'd be more comfortable just continuing to sort of mold Jameis. And Jameis has made strides in the second half. And Jameis certainly has a lot of ability, but stuff just happens when he's on the field. Weird stuff just happens. And a lot of times that results in the ball being in the other team's hands, even when it's not Jameis's fault. But saying all that, and the GM, Jason Light, has obviously, you know, completely married himself to Jameis Winston. But I think what BA is alluding to lately, after coming out so strong pro-Jameis in the past, is that it's not going to be his call, you know. The guy's a free agent. He's making now over $20 million a year. The Glazer family is going to have a decision to make in terms of whether they want to continue to invest those sort of assets in this particular quarterback.
And he said Bruce Allen, he meant Bruce Arians. Bruce Allen used to be the GM down in Tampa Bay. I understand why Jason got just words mixed up during the course of that answer. You understand the point. He's been in on him before, but it's not necessarily his call after 5 years on the job and the amount of money that you have to commit to a quarterback. So we're going to play a little game with Jameis Winston. And this is why it's still under consideration. Even though every year they've got a losing record, even though he throws all these interceptions, you see some of the upside. You see the 22 touchdown passes. You see the ridiculous numbers that both Mike Evans and Chris Godwin have put up with Winston at the helm this year. And it's always been the same thing with Jameis Winston. If he can just cut out a few of those mistakes, man, think of what might be possible. If you play in a fantasy league that does not punish you for turnovers, Jameis Winston's fine. Now, he might have a week like he did last week where he just doesn't score. But then there's other weeks where, yeah, he threw four picks, but because I'm not getting punished in my fantasy league, Jameis looks pretty good. Jameis, one of the best quarterbacks this week, because in addition to the four interceptions he threw, he happened to throw four touchdowns. He has games like that. So we're going to play a little game here, Jamie. I'm going to bring you on. See where Jameis Winston ranks for you. Where does he rank in all of the quarterbacks in this league? And I think that will give a better indication to why they would consider keeping Jameis in Tampa Bay after this year. They may not do it, and there's two reasons why that I will give you right after we do this exercise, Jamie, but it's why it's under consideration. So I'm going to have you rank him right now. We obviously know he's not in the top 10, so I'm not even going to ask you with these guys. I'm not even going to ask you if you'd prefer these guys, because I know you would. Deshaun Watson, Russell Wilson, Lamar Jackson, Tom Brady, Drew Brees, Patrick Mahomes, Aaron Rodgers, Matt Ryan, Dak Prescott, Ben Roethlisberger. For just next season, you would take any of those guys over Jameis?
Absolutely, no question.
Okay, so let's start after that. I think there's other names you're going to say, I'd have that guy instead of Jameis, but let's start there. Kirk Cousins.
Yes.
Matt Stafford.
Yes.
Carson Wentz.
Yes.
Kyler Murray.
I'm a bigger fan of Kyler Murray than a lot of people, so I would say yes, for sure.
Doesn't turn the ball over as much.
No.
And he's young.
Got more potential with his legs, yeah.
Baker Mayfield.
Yeah, I still would. I mean, I feel like a sucker a little bit saying that, but I see the upside more than with Jameis, so I would take Baker.
What about Josh Allen?
Josh Allen's been on a nice little run here. He's been on a nice run.
He's certainly not perfect, but his team wins.
I think I would take Josh Allen.
Jacoby Brissett.
This is a tough one because do I get... It depends on the environment around him, I think. Like, I think maybe... I have a lot of respect for the Colts coaching staff, so if Jameis Winston was on the Colts, I bet he'd be winning a lot of games. I think I would take Jameis over Jacoby Brissett, but it's close. It's really close.
Derek Carr.
I'd take Derek Carr.
Ryan Tannehill.
I'd take Jameis.
Andy Dalton.
Jameis.
Phillip Rivers. Just for next year.
Just for next year. I still got to go Phillip Rivers, but it's close.
Jared Goff.
Oh. Ooh. I think I talk about, again, talk about, like, trying to separate the environment and the coaching from all that. I think just in a vacuum, I would take Jameis.
Jimmy Garoppolo.
I would take Jimmy.
Sam Darnold.
Jameis.
Mitch Trubisky.
Jameis with the capital J.
Kyle Allen.
Jameis.
Daniel Jones.
Jameis.
Dwayne Haskins.
Yeah, Jameis for sure.
Drew Locke.
No doubt, Jameis.
And Josh Rosen.
No doubt.
I did not even put Ryan Fitzpatrick in the mix there. Would you take Ryan Fitzpatrick over Jameis?
I don't know.
For 1 year next year?
They started him a little bit last year. I know there was injuries there. Maybe I would. I don't know. Fitzmagic.
So based on this, and there's two names, three really, that I've left off this conversation, but based on what I just rolled out to you, you kind of have him around number 20, which puts him in the top two-thirds of the league, and that's kind of the cusp of where he's at. And so Jameis Winston, this is why they're considering it. And that's the reason we went through that exercise. Some people might have him a little lower, some people might have him a little higher, but that's kind of where he's at. He's around 20, 22, which isn't great. But people think, you know, maybe if we cut out a few turnovers, this will be okay.
The name that really kind of perked my interest there, because I think there's a lot of similarities, is Jared Goff. And they're in that same tier where it's not a simple decision to just say, oh, get rid of this guy, but the risk of
Rams
committing...
Rams can't get rid of their guy now.
Exactly.
They
the
paid
risk
him.
Of committing is huge. That's why this is such a difficult decision, and I think that's why we heard, one, Bruce Arians kind of push it to the future, but also what Lacan Forrest said, a decision of this magnitude with this much risk, it really has to come from ownership in the NFL. That's how important the quarterback position is.
So here are the three other names that make this more complicated in Tampa Bay. I'm going to give them to you right now. One of them I don't think is more complicated, but the other two are. Marcus Mariota is one of them. He's going to be a free agent. He's hurt too much.
Yeah.
So I don't think that's a guy you're saying, okay, we're cashing in. We're going to pay him to come in. I like Marcus Mariota. I like the intangibles, all of those things, but he hasn't proven to be a decent passer consistently in this league. Teddy Bridgewater and Cam Newton are the two guys who really make this an interesting conversation. Teddy Bridgewater signed the deal to stay in New Orleans. It really paid off for the Saints. It actually has really paid off for him as well because he went 5-0 when Drew Brees was out. And now free agent interest is going to be even higher in Teddy Bridgewater this year than it was last year. Cam Newton's the other one. Now, he's getting foot surgery, but this is a former MVP. So those are the two guys that, to me, make this discussion infinitely more interesting down in Tampa Bay. Would you keep Jameis over healthy Cam? Probably not, but you don't know if Cam's going to be healthy. What about Teddy Bridgewater? He is in many ways the polar opposite of Jameis Winston.
Absolutely.
He is risk-averse with a lot of his throws. He doesn't turn the ball over very often, but he also doesn't give you the big pop. He doesn't give you big numbers. He's not a fantasy quarterback, which is why people perhaps that just play fantasy football and just worry about that are down on a guy like Teddy Bridgewater. He's what you would call a game manager.
And I was one of I'm not a huge Jameis Winston fan, but I was kind of expecting a big year from him this year because of Bruce Arians going down there. And what do we know about Bruce Arians? He's great with quarterbacks, and he loves to go vertical down the field looking for big plays. That should theoretically play into Jameis's strengths. And that's also why I don't necessarily see the fit with Teddy Bridgewater. Does Bruce Arians want to bring in that kind of, you know, game manager quarterback, or is he going to be drawn to the big play potential of Jameis Winston still?
It's a fair point. It's a fair point. And Arians has had a lot of success with guys that have had critiques on them before. Remember how many games he won in Arizona with Carson Palmer? People thought Palmer was washed at that point. Remember any games he won with, like, Drew Stanton?
Yeah.
In Arizona. So I understand why Bruce Arians thinks he can fix guys or can succeed with guys who have what appear to be very obvious flaws. This one comes in from a Bucs fan who says, I'd take Kaepernick over Winston. I didn't put him in the discussion because no NFL team seems to want to hire him. This Bucs fan says, I'd even take RG3 over Winston. That's interesting. There's a backup in Baltimore. I don't think the Bucs would take RG3 over Winston, but I understand the frustration that I'm hearing from this Bucs fan on the text message inbox.
The Kaepernick name is interesting because I, from the outside looking in, I can see Arians being the kind of coach who would take the chance on Kaepernick.
Can you see the Glazer family?
That's the issue. It's the ownership question. Arians might say, yeah, sign me up, but I don't see the Glazers saying, okay, we're going to invest in Colin Kaepernick as our starting quarterback.
More NFL football coming your way just after the top of the hour. Starting offensive lineman, Canadian with the Kansas City Chiefs, Laurent Duvernay-Tardif is going to join us, the good doctor, just after the top. But let's get to what they're saying.
Bro, what are you talking about, man?
What are you saying?
Not saying anything.
You're saying something?
I guess that's what I'm saying, Brooksy.
Here's what they're saying.
The conversation continues in hockey. I alluded to this earlier, and it's a daily talking point. And there were some interesting things to come out. Mark Crawford has had his name in the news lately. He is not right now with the Chicago Blackhawks. Leave of absence while they go through this investigation. Harold Druckin made an allegation this week. Brian Burke is the general manager who hired Mark Crawford in Vancouver. That's the time when Harold Druckin played here. It's the time when Brent Sopel played here. He was on the morning show, the starting lineup in Vancouver today with Perry Salkowski and Mike English, and had this to say about the conversation we're having right now and specifically how it pertains to Mark Crawford.
No, I don't think there's this big backlog of players with grievances. I really don't. And that's why I said on TV a week ago, if this is our Me Too movement, then bring it on. Let's air it out. I think there are some players that are airing grievances that are reasonable and some that are not. And I will tell you this, because they asked Kenny Holland yesterday, did you ever see any conduct from Mike Babcock? I will tell you this. I saw Mark Crawford kick Brent Sopel once. He apologized personally to Sopes. And then again, in front of the team, I told him if it happened again, I'd fire him. All this other stuff where they say Crow is this and that, I worked with him for 5.5 years. I travel with him with the team. I travel with him socially. He and his wife and my wife went to Napa twice. And so I had every opportunity. I was at most practices. I was at every game. I was on the bus. Never saw him savage a player getting on the bus as he walked by and rip him, which I've seen other coaches do. Never saw him abuse anyone. Never saw him belittle anyone. So this is all news to me. I'm not saying it didn't happen, but it didn't happen in front of me.
So Brian Burke talks about the Brent Sopel incident, says, I can't tell you that I saw anything else. I'm not saying anything else didn't happen, but that's the conversation around Mark Crawford right now. We'll see if there's any more allegations that come up. And I do think it's important to play Robin Lehner here. He had an extremely candid conversation with Mark Lazarus, who does The Athletic in Chicago. And you can hear the conversation and you can read the article at The Athletic. And Robin Lehner is somewhat coming to the defense of the coaches under fire. Somewhat. He's not defending them and all of their actions completely. He's not doing that at all. I don't want to misconstrue this. But what Robin Lehner is talking about is cancel culture, and he is opening up this conversation, which I think is extremely important. And part of the reason that he had this conversation with Mark Lazarus is that he's obviously a guy who's had second chances, but Mark Crawford, it's a pertinent situation in Chicago because he's been excused from the team. Here's what Robin Lehner had to say yesterday.
I believe everyone deserves a second chance, even if they've been bad people. I've been a bad person. Carcillo, who leads this charge right now, he's been a bad person. Mm-hmm. And now he gets to cancel people out. Now he gets to cancel because he's done his career and he's finally doing good. Mm-hmm. I really commend him for ending the cycle of abuse, what he's done now. It doesn't mean that he and that whole movement and cancel culture in general gets to destroy these people's lives without a fair process and an opportunity to change. Why do you have to lose your whole life? Why do you have to lose everything to be able to come back? Because you can't come back after that. Don't tell me that Peters is going to be back in the league.
So that's only a part of it. Now, there's a lot more there. We don't have the time to play it all. I would ask you, if you're interested in this conversation, I think most of you are, I would ask you to go listen to the Robin Lehner interview. I would ask you to read it. It's posted on The Athletic, and it's very lengthy, and he has a lot of pertinent things to say. I don't agree with everything he says either. In the same way that Robin Lehner is saying, hey, I know hockey culture is under attack here, coaches are under attack, he's basically saying it was a different set of circumstances. This is something many of you have brought up. Well, we've had this conversation on this show and said, well, are we going to apply 2019 standards to things that happened in 2002, 1997, 2008? It's a fair point, and it's part of this conversation. And I also think we can't blanket cancel culture as well, use that term. And a lot of people want to go down that road, and they just throw that blanket cancel culture over everything. Bill Peters, for example, does he deserve a second chance? Maybe he does. But you also have to earn a second chance. And people say, well, why does a guy have to lose his job? Well, there are certain transgressions that have consequences like this. And the transgression Bill Peters had cost him his job because it is deemed one that you cannot make in 2009, you cannot make in 2019. And that is not someone who a team wants to pay right now to represent its organization. That doesn't mean, and to Lehner's point in that clip, and this is the ongoing conversation, that doesn't mean we erase that person. Do we discard that person from society? No, I would hope not. I would hope that there is education. I would hope that there is rehabilitation. And I would hope that if a guy like Bill Peters puts in the work, that he will be given another opportunity. Maybe it's not at the NHL level. Maybe he coaches at a junior level. Maybe he coaches at a minor league level. Maybe he becomes an advocate for the proper way to deal with athletes. Maybe he has education and rehabilitation. He's just one example. Mike Babcock may have to undergo some sort of therapy. He may have to undergo more education if he wants another opportunity. To the same point, why do people have to lose everything? Your job isn't everything. Robin Lehner knows that. Robin Lehner knows that the second chance he got after the demons he has battled, and I agree with him wholeheartedly at the heart of his conversation, is mental illness education. Mental health education is at the heart of all of this. I agree with that completely. But your second chance doesn't always come at the highest level. Robin Lehner's second chance didn't come as you are a locked-in number one starter. here you go. That's not the second chance he got. He had to earn his way back, and he earned his way back to winning a Masterton, to winning a nomination for the Vezina last year. Do I think he should have been paid more in the open market? Yes, I do. I'm also not a general manager. And I would think if Robin Lehner continues to play the way he's played this year, he's going to get a better contract, and he's going to get a longer contract. He earned a second chance, and he's making the most of his second chance. But this is part of the ongoing conversation. Earning the second chance, putting in that work. And I understand why people get frustrated by what is called cancel culture. We can't just erase people. We shouldn't just erase people. I'm not a believer in that. There are certain transgressions in society that once you cross that line, okay, I'm not sure where your second chance comes. That's not necessarily what we're talking about here. There have been other incidents in hockey in the past. Graham James, for example, I don't think you deserve a second chance. Sorry. No second chance once you've crossed that line. Not for me. No chance. But there is the ability to rehabilitate. There's the ability to educate. And I hope we take those opportunities as well. Excellent stuff from Robin Lehner yesterday. We've got to make way for a big man. Laurent Duvernay-Tardif, one of the more prominent Canadians in the NFL right now. He does not check a box that I think a lot of people would like checked. Very soon, it could happen as soon as next year. I'll explain next on the Scott Rintoul Show.
Welcome to the Scott Rintoul Show.
Hubbard having a good one here. Trying to go off to the races. Cuba from Canada and beyond. That is track speed. Wow. You give him an opening, forget about it. You're not going to be able to catch him. 92 yards to the house.
That might be the guy. That might be the guy who changes the conversation that we've had around our studios for the last couple of years, and we all want the same thing, but we haven't seen it yet. We might as soon as next year. Scott Rintoul with you, making way for Laurent Duvernay-Tardif. Calling sometime in the next 10 minutes, we will talk with the Kansas City Chiefs offensive lineman about what's going on as they prepare for the New England Patriots. There's some really good games this coming weekend. We'll do our six-pack for the weekend tomorrow, but as we tease it a little bit, Week 14 gets going tonight. Dallas taking on Chicago. Doesn't feel like a great game. Doesn't feel like a great game. It has some playoff implications for the Dallas Cowboys, probably not for the Chicago Bears, but there are some really good games this weekend. I mentioned New England and Kansas City going head-to-head. That one in New England. You've got the Rams and the Seahawks down in L.A. That's your Sunday nighter. 49ers, one of your big watch must-see games again this weekend. 49ers and Saints, a pair of 10-2 teams squaring off. That game for the 49ers, another road game. Back-to-back weeks where they've gone on the road against teams with same records, and they've had to actually they had a better record going in against Baltimore. They come out of it the same, both 10-2, but tough environments for them to go into in back-to-back weeks. And then you've got the Ravens and the Bills. Maybe an underrated good game. Bills can play some D. Our opinion of the Cowboys has shifted a lot over the course of the year. I still don't think many people expected Buffalo to go in and beat Dallas. Just because it's Dallas, it's Thanksgiving, they've got Zeke, they've got Dak, they've got Amari. They can play some defense. Josh Allen, Bills went in there, they ran that show. They were great. Really good in fashioning their ninth win of the season, and now they get to host Lamar Jackson and the Baltimore Ravens. Bills, of course, they'll be underdogs at home, hottest team in football, the Ravens, 8 straight wins. We'll talk about it more tomorrow, but really good weekend on tap in the National Football League. Chuba Hubbard. If you're a college football fan, you know who he is. If you are a fan of prominent Canadian athletes in the NCAA, you probably know who he is. Is he the guy who can change the conversation? And again, if you want to be in on our conversations, you've got the fan feedback line. You've got the text line as well. Hit me up. I see them all. We work them into our conversations. And you have some excellent stuff, certainly regarding Robin Lehner, that we will get into this hour. Chuba Hubbard, if you don't know who he is, the young man is from Edmonton. He's from Sherwood Park. And he was a phenom playing minor football up in Edmonton, but that doesn't always translate to NCAA success. He led the NCAA in rushing this year. Almost 2,000 yards. 1,936 yards this year. He had 21 touchdowns. That was second in NCAA football. He is probably not going to be a Heisman finalist, but he has a really good case to be one. I would love to see him get there. I'd love to see him on that stage. He's not going to win it. Joe Burrow of LSU, he's going to win that award. And then it's just about who the other four guys are who are the Heisman finalists with him this year. I would love it if Hubbard was one of them. He's probably not going to be. His team didn't have enough success. And we all know that when it comes down to this type of voting, these major awards, voters do take that into account. Oklahoma State, they just weren't great overall this year. They weren't as good as some of the big teams out there. They're not Ohio State. They're not LSU. They don't get the same type of recognition. So it doesn't matter for a lot of people that he led the nation in rushing. His team wasn't as good, so he will get discounted for that. This guy's a finalist for the Doak Walker Award, which is given annually to the best running back in all of college football. He was just named the Big 12's Offensive Player of the Year. And he's going to go in the NFL draft next year. At least I expect him to go in the NFL draft next year. I'm not sure why he wouldn't. I have no idea why he'd go back to school and put more miles on his body for a position that doesn't last particularly long in the National Football League.
Usually good for a running back to just get out while the getting's good.
So Chuba Hubbard is likely going to be in the draft, and he's going to be selected by somebody, which means, and we all know what rookie running backs can do, not every single one, but the guys, it doesn't matter if you're first, second, third, fourth, go down the list. You can be a player. You can be a, is he fourth round selection or third? Alvin Kamara burst onto the scene, Offensive Rookie of the Year. Josh Jacobs, a first round selection this year by Oakland. He's probably going to win the Offensive Rookie of the Year. But if you're a running back and you're young and you don't have a lot of wear and tear on the body, you're going to get a chance in most situations. Chuba Hubbard might be. He might become the first Canadian true fantasy football guy since fantasy football exploded. Luke Wilson tap danced around the edges. I love Luke Wilson, but he was never a prominent pass-catching tight end. He hasn't been that. He's a better blocker than he is pass catcher. That's how he's seen. He's had big games. He had over 100 yards on Thursday Night Football, scored a couple of touchdowns, but he hasn't been a regular install in the week-to-week fantasy football players lineup. He's been what you'd call a streaming option. Your regular tight end's out. Luke Wilson's a guy you could plug in for a week. Yeah, maybe he hits. He's available. Maybe I'll take him. Chuba Hubbard could be that guy. And we haven't really had that guy in the fantasy football era. There are Canadians playing in the league. We're going to talk to one in just a few minutes. Laurent Duvernay-Tardif. You don't start offensive lineman in fantasy football. He's had a fantastic career thus far. I wish him all the best. But there are a lot of people who aren't X's and O's consumers. They don't like to break down tape. They don't really care that much about offensive and defensive line play. What they care about, wide receivers, running backs, quarterbacks, tight ends, maybe kickers. We've seen Canadian kickers before, but not really in the prominent era of fantasy football. Steve Christie, he was doing it before people were really playing fantasy football. Same with Mike Vanderjagt. Unless you are somebody from way back playing Dynasty Fantasy Football. But Hubbard could be that guy. He can be a household name. And we haven't had that. The last guy who might qualify is Jerome Paython. But again, that's at the outset of fantasy football really becoming mainstream. How long has it been really mainstream? 10 years? Maybe not that long for all of you. I've certainly been playing it for a very long time. I've been in a couple of dynasty leagues going on two decades in one case. But we haven't had a real prominent Canadian. We've had the guy that you might plug and play, the guy you like to have on your roster. Could Chuba Hubbard be that guy? I hope so. That'd be great. You look at what Canadians have done in the NBA. Steve Nash, most prominently. Guys going number one in the draft. We've got NBA players. We've got star players. Perhaps not superstar players beyond Steve Nash. We got star players in the NBA. We've got MVPs in Major League Baseball. Joey Votto, Larry Walker, Mike Soroka just finished second in NL rookie voting, I should say, rookie of the year voting.
James Paxton starting big games for the Yankees in the playoffs.
We've hit that. We've crossed that threshold. We've had very prominent players, prominent hitters, prominent pitchers got it all for Canadians there. But the NFL, we haven't cracked that. CFL, obviously, by virtue of the rules, we have a lot of prominent Canadians. And they've had great careers, and some of them have tried their shot. Some of them have gone south. They've kicked around NFL rosters here or there, but not prominent fantasy football players. And I care about the sport. I care about all the positions. I love it. But I know most people don't consume it that way. They like the highlights. They want to watch Red Zone. And they want to know, what are you doing for my team? Are you catching touchdowns? In my PPR league, do you have 7 receptions this week? That's what people mostly want to know. They want skill position guys. And we haven't had a prominent guy. We might get one.
It drives name recognition to a wider audience. That's how you really... That's how a lot of people experience the league now, is who's good from a fantasy perspective. I mean, we were talking about that when the Jameis Winston conversation came up, right? Like, a lot of people perceive him in a certain way because of fantasy football. And maybe, you know, in a perfect world, maybe Duvernay-Tardif would be getting a lot more publicity in Canada because he is a great offensive lineman. But you're right. You need that guy who's getting the rock, who's taking it to the house, to really explode in the national consciousness.
Aaron in South Surrey sends this in. What about Nate Burleson? By passport, yes. By birthplace, yes. Nate Burleson is Canadian. He was born in Calgary. However, I do think as Canadians, we view it a little bit differently, don't we? View it a little bit differently. If you were raised here, if you went through your minor football, in this case, in Canada, and then made it. And I think we view it a little differently. Yep, Nate Burleson was a prominent receiver, and technically he's Canadian, but does he pass the smell test that way? I'm glad he's proud of his heritage. I think he does a lot of great stuff in terms of making himself available to come on Tim and Sid, for example, and he's proud of his Canadian heritage. But I don't think it feels the same. Does it? Feel free to correct me if I'm wrong. You've got the feedback mechanisms. You can hit me up right here. I do want to get into some of your comments. One of the conversations we were having in the first hour of the show, and as we expect this phone call from Laurent Duvernay-Tardif, I just want to toss this out to you as well. Who do you think the most underappreciated players in hockey are right now? Brendan Morrison's going to join me in 25 minutes' time. I'll ask him as well. Jack Eichel's making his way through Western Canada, starts tonight in Calgary. I think he's on that list. He might be at the top of that list. You know he's good. You know he had a lot of points last year. Do you really appreciate him? And I talked about Chuba Hubbard having a great year, but not getting the national recognition because his team just didn't have the same type of success as others. Kind of feels that way for Jack Eichel. And that's where Alex Barkov was before. Barkov, I think, has crossed that threshold. I don't think you can call Alex Barkov the most underrated player in the game anymore, or the most underappreciated in the game anymore. Because last year was a year where he burst onto the scene, he got an award, he was close to 100 points. I think now people have a better appreciation. His teammate, however, Jonathan Huberdeau, I think that's a conversation we can have. That's a guy we can most certainly talk about. Jack Eichel, Jonathan Huberdeau. What about Artemi Panarin? Enough appreciation for Artemi Panarin? Is it just because the Rangers haven't been great this year that people haven't talked about him? He's got 33 points, tied for 10th in scoring. Allie in Calgary says, how about DeBrincat? People appreciated Alex DeBrincat last year.
Last year, yeah, got a lot of love. This year,
41 goals. I don't know if you could say he's underappreciated this year. He's got 5. He's had a rough go. Really tough go for Alex DeBrincat this year. Keep sending them in. We'll get to some more of your submissions. Mikko Rantanen was sent in. I don't think he qualifies anymore, does he? Mikko Rantanen had a big year, big-time year last year. Got paid in the offseason as well. We talked a lot about Mikko Rantanen. He's in the shadow of his teammate. I mentioned that with Huberdeau. He's in Barkov's shadow. So, yeah, Rantanen qualifies in that realm, but I'm not sure he's underappreciated. John Gibson was someone that got sent in. I think that's a good call. I do think John Gibson is underappreciated. John Gibson is phenomenal, but plays on a team that's just not great. Last year, awful. This year, better. Getting back to respectability, young team, turnover, new coach, all of those things. But I don't think John Gibson gets appreciated enough for how good he is.
What they asked John Gibson to do last year, was, it was cruel, really, in a sense. But my goodness, the amount of rubber that he faced last year and that he was able to hold up until relatively late in the season was incredible. So I absolutely agree. If he was on a decent team, he'd be getting much, much more buzz.
Matthew Barzell is a name that got sent in as well. I think that's a good call. His numbers got depressed last year because the Islanders play a different way now. It's not as loosey-goosey as when he was putting up more than a point a game as a rookie. You think about how good Elias Pettersson's rookie season was, 66 points. Matthew Barzell put up over 80. He had a great year. Slam dunk winner of the Calder Trophy. Plays in a little different system now, doesn't get the big numbers. I think Matthew Barzell's underappreciated. I think that's a good call. New York, it's not a team that people look at that much. They don't hit the highlights. I think we appreciate the team, but we don't necessarily appreciate the individual talents on New York. Someone also sent in Brian Rust. I can't put him on that list. Brian Rust having a nice season. Brian Rust has, I believe, 17 points in 14 games, but Brian Rust is not a guy that ever had, he's never hit 40 points. I'm not sure Brian Rust qualifies for being underappreciated right now in hockey. Keep sending those texts in. We get them. We use them as part of our conversation as well. We're awaiting the call of Laurent Duvernay-Tardif, offensive lineman with the Kansas City Chiefs. I have somebody sending this in, and hey, if I'm wrong on this, correct me. I don't think I am. Someone says, who cares about fantasy? Wasting too much time pandering to people that don't even like the sport unless it's fantasy. I care about the Canadian kid because he's a great football player, not because of some fantasy crap. Please stop pandering to the people who don't even care about the sport. GB. You got to understand, GB, that's a vehicle for a lot of people to the sport. That's how they get in. If they haven't been following football, if they haven't been NFL fans forever, and they need an easy vehicle into the game, that gets them in. And then you hope over time, and I'm big on this with any sport. I really am. In the era we live in right now, we can talk about live attendance and why it's down. People want entertainment first and foremost. That's the way things have changed. When I grew up, going to a sporting event, you were less concerned about the win and the loss and the entertainment surrounding it. The sport itself was good enough. Not anymore. That's not where we live in 2019. We live in a time where, I'm sorry, you got to give me more for my hard-earned dollar. Well, what's the glitz and glam around your event? Because sports cost a lot. Hey, I know you can watch at home, but not everybody grew up as a football player. Not everybody grew up loving the sport. They don't necessarily understand. It's a complex sport. When you think about football in particular, and hockey falls into this category as well, as far as TV viewing goes. If you didn't grow up with it, I know people kind of laugh. I've had this come in before when I made this point about hockey, that if you didn't grow up with hockey and you don't have the anticipatory knowledge of where the puck is probably going to go, it's not easy to follow. And people say, HDTV, little black disc on a white surface. Yeah, it's really tough. It moves pretty fast. And if you don't have any idea what might be happening, again, put yourself in the shoes of somebody who's never seen the sport before. Tough to find. And so the best way for me to get people into hockey is to take them to a live game. And they have a greater appreciation, and then they want to watch it on TV. With football, there is a lot going on. I got two young kids. They're not necessarily real interested in football at 6 and almost 3. But there's a lot to explain. It's one of the most complex sports out there. Why is this a penalty and that's not? All of those different things. It's a tough one to explain. So if fantasy football can be a vehicle into that, I don't have any issue with that. If hearing that going to a minor league baseball game is just going to be fun, you don't care about baseball, but that's your vehicle into the sport, I think that's great. Keep sending your texts in, but we're going to talk to a guy who's getting ready for the New England Patriots this weekend. Starting offensive lineman with the Kansas City Chiefs, Dr. Laurent Duvernay-Tardif joins me now. How are you, sir?
Pretty good. Yourself?
I'm doing very well. You're a doctor, so if I ask you to assess the health of the Chiefs right now, not literally, but figuratively, where's your team at right now as you enter the final quarter of the season?
I mean, I think the last 2 weeks has been pretty good for us. We're getting into a rhythm, and like all three phases of the team are performing well, especially after the win last weekend. So I think we're feeling pretty good, and we're fine tuning and getting ready for the New England Patriots this weekend. It's gonna be a big one.
Yes, you are. You've seen the Ravens. You've seen the Texans. Now you're about to play the Patriots. In your opinion, how do the Chiefs stack up right now with the other division leaders in the AFC?
I mean, I think we're, like I said, we're playing pretty good. I think we had a few misfire earlier in the season, but as the season getting along, we're playing better as a team. We've been able to run the ball a little better too over the last couple of weeks, so that's good. And I mean, that's what you want at this time of the season. You want a team that's able to like bring all three phases together and perform well as a team, which we were able to do the last 2 weeks.
Laurent Duvernay-Tardif joining me here, starting offensive lineman with the Kansas City Chiefs. This is your third meeting with the Patriots over the course of the last two seasons. You guys met in the regular season last year, you met in the playoffs, and now there's this weekend. When you look at this Patriots D on film right now, how is it different to prepare for New England this time compared to what you saw last year?
I mean, the New England Patriots are known to like kind of game plan the opponent really well. So I feel like every time you play them, you can expect a few wrinkles. But at the end of the day, it's still the same core of defensive player that's been playing together for a long time. So they're well experienced. They play well together. So you got to be able on the offense, especially on the offensive line, to like switch those twists, like expect man coverage and be able to beat it up outside. I think we have a lot of speed on our offense, and that's going to be key this weekend if we want to score points.
I know you're just back in the last couple of weeks. You had an injury earlier this year, but even watching your team prior to this weekend, what's the best defense you've seen this year?
That's a good question. I mean, from a defensive line standpoint, I think the Chargers were pretty hard to beat, you know, with Bosa and Ingram on the outside. It's a really tough D-line to play against. Overall, I want to say the Ravens were probably a pretty good defense, and for sure the Patriots coming up have really, really good numbers. So I think we're facing a bunch of really good defense this year, and we got to be ready for everything.
That's not a bad way to prepare for the playoffs. Laurent Duvernay-Tardif joining me here, the good doctor on the Scott Rintoul Show. Last year's playoff experience, it obviously ended against the New England Patriots in overtime in Kansas City. How has that experience, Laurent, made this team better this year?
I mean, I think we're kind of past that. Of course, we remember the feeling. You know, it was pretty terrible to not have a chance to get back on the field after that score in overtime. But I think as a team, we moved on, and we're a different team this year. They're a different team this year, so we're just preparing to go against them and get physical. And, you know, I remember, I mean, that last year we lost against them in Foxborough, but 2 years ago for the opening of the 2018 season or 2017 season, we went down there and we were able to get the ball and dominate the line of scrimmage. I think we're all pretty confident in our ability to go down there and play a physical game. And
you talked about how New England is tough to prepare for. They've got the GOAT as far as head coaches go, but the guy you play for, he's pretty good. Andy Reid, players love him. Why is he such a good coach to play for?
I mean, Coach Reid is just the ultimate team player. You know, he wants to put you as an individual and collectively in the best position to make plays, and that's what he's known for. And he's been able to like design play to really take advantage of our strength and the defense weakness over the last years. And it's really great to play for a coach like that really gives you an opportunity to show what you can do, and that really wants you to show your personality on the field and play with that swagger.
Do you guys feel overlooked at all this year, Laurent? Because people are talking Ravens. Obviously, the Patriots get some run. Do you guys feel overlooked?
No. I mean, I think we're right where we want to be. And at the end of the day, it's not a matter of like how you start or how the year goes. It's how you finish that last quarter of the season. It's December football. It's cold. It's nice out. And that's it's for those kind of moments that you prepare, that you want to play for, getting ready for the playoffs.
you mentioned what Andy Reid does and how he utilizes the weapons. Well, you guys have a lot of weapons. I could ask you about so many of them, but let's go with Travis Kelce. He's on the verge of some NFL history. If he gets to 1,000 yards, which he likely will, he'd be the first guy ever to have four consecutive 1,000-yard receiving seasons as a tight end. He's part pass catcher. He's part lineman. From an O-lineman's point of view, what impresses you about Travis Kelce's skill set?
I mean, you got to respect the guy. He's an awesome team player, and the way he's able to like get open and run his route, you know, it's not always like the most explosive route, but he's always able to get open, always able to give a little like head fake to beat man coverage and get open, and he's also a tremendous blocker. You know, we have a lot of play where we put him one on one versus the DN, and he's able to lock these guys down. So he's a great all around player, and of course as an offensive lineman you look for those stats and those catches, but you also really respect the ability to block in the run game, and that's what he's been able to do so well.
Did you ever play any tight end growing up?
No. Me and the football don't go very well together. I never want to catch a football.
Never. Come on. We can't have one of those plays where you come in as an extra old lineman, but you're lined up as a tight end, and we make you eligible, and you run into the end zone. We can't do that.
Well, I mean, we could, but honestly, I prefer just being able to start as a right guard. It's a really a privilege, and I wanted to stay that way.
Sounds good. Hey, best of luck this weekend. Thanks for making time. We always appreciate it when you do. It's one of the highlight games of the weekend, the Chiefs and the Patriots, and we'll be watching you.
Hey, thank you so much. Have a good show.
I certainly will. Thank you. Have a good game. It's Dr. Laurent Duvernay-Tardif. He's always a breath of fresh air. He's had a fabulous career getting things started in Kansas City. And as I mentioned earlier, one of the highlight games of this weekend, Chiefs and Patriots. Follow up on that, and we will also talk to our weekly regular about who he thinks might be the most underappreciated player in hockey. Brendan Morrison is next on the Scott Rintoul Show.
Now more of the Scott Rintoul Show.
At what point don't you qualify anymore? That's really the question of the conversation we're having when it comes to underappreciated or underrated in the National Hockey League. Scott Rintoul with you. A couple of minutes away from hooking up with Brendan Morrison, weekly regular, former Flame, former Canuck. Played for a number of teams. Capitals, Blackhawks, New Jersey Devils, where he started his career. Brendan will join us in just a couple minutes' time. Ask him who he thinks the most underappreciated player is right now in the National Hockey League. The genesis of this conversation, the guy who's going to play in Calgary tonight, Jack Eichel. The point totals are there. The Sabres have not had a winning product for his entire career. It all fell apart last season. They're three games over 500 now, had the excellent start. They've come back down to earth, steadied the ship a little recently. But is he underappreciated? Seventh in league scoring right now. And because in Western Canada, we don't always see him. We don't always get to see the early games. Depending on what your job is, you might not get home in time. You might see it on the highlights, or maybe it's not one that you catch, or maybe you don't even watch a sports highlight show anymore. Maybe it's all on demand for you on your computer, on your mobile device, whenever you want it. So do you consider him one of or the most underappreciated player in the league? And we've had a lot of responses to this. And some of them that have come in lately, I think, have crossed the threshold of, well, you can't be underappreciated anymore because we've talked about you a lot. Dex sent in Ryan O'Reilly. Ryan O'Reilly, to me, is appreciated. He was the Conn Smythe winner. He won the Selke last year. He's a Stanley Cup champion at 90 points. Ryan O'Reilly, to me, is appreciated. I don't think he's underappreciated anymore. I think prior to last season, you could have made that argument, and it would have been a great one. And he's a guy that, over the course of last year's NHL regular season campaign, didn't get enough run. The Blues were awful at the start. Ryan O'Reilly hadn't had any playoff success in Colorado. It hadn't worked out in Buffalo. People wondered, I don't know if this guy's ever going to be on, a good team. And then the Blues completely turned it around, and O'Reilly got the accolades. So I think he is properly appreciated. Someone sent John Carlson, first D-man to get 100 since Leach. He might be. And you could make the case for Carlson. I don't think he's underappreciated right now. He was leading the NHL in scoring, got a lot of run. I think that attention faded a little bit. But now with what he's doing lately and the attention he's getting, he's got 42 points already. I ran the numbers for you at the top of the show today. John Carlson has 42 points in 30 games. He might have 50 points since Christmas. The most points any defenseman has had since the turn of the century is 83, and that was Brent Burns last year. John Carlson is more than halfway there in 30 games. It's really remarkable. Brendan Morrison, he likes him some John Carlson, I imagine. Some Jack Eichel he could possibly see tonight in Calgary, and he joins me now as he does every single week. How you doing, Mo?
Good, Scotty. How you making out?
I'm doing very well. I was talking about John Carlson and just the season he's having, and people obviously are on board with this as well. 42 points in 30 games, Mo. You didn't see anything like that from a defenseman in your career.
Well, you know, that's a pretty impressive pace for sure. Interesting enough is I played with John Carlson in Washington when I was there in 2009, 2010. He was just a rookie on that team there and a young kid and obviously had a bright future, but I don't know if anybody expected this to happen. That year too, Mike Green had a huge year points wise. I think he put up, geez, I don't know what he was at there. He had to be, he was over 70 points that year, I think, Mike Green. But yeah, I mean, a start like this before Christmas, I mean, think about it back to the first month of the season, he was leading the league in scoring. I mean, he's dropped a bit now, but I mean, the pace he's on is incredible.
76 points in 2009-2010 for Mike Green. I believe that was his best season. He's not bad.
You know, and I think he probably should have won the Norris that year. You know, that was a fun team. We won the President's Trophy, you know, went on like a 14 or 15 game winning streak. And it was like rock star mode traveling around with Obi. It was a lot of fun. It was cool.
And when Semin decided to make the trip, he had fun too. I digress. Brendan,
he scored 40 that year, man.
Of course he did. As you've said, he's the most talented player you've ever been on the ice with, on the same team with, which is remarkable considering you were playing with Ovechkin.
I stand by that, yeah.
Brendan Morrison joining me as he does every single Thursday. So Mike Green, you tell me if this was fair or unfair. He got categorized as a defenseman who was really good offensively but not great defensively. Fair or unfair?
That's fair. No, that's a fair assessment. He very, very gifted offensively. Wasn't, you know, maybe as concerned or as focused as playing in his own end. But, yeah, I mean, he was a phenomenal talent, no question.
John Carlson, would you say he's in that same category or no? He is excellent defensively, and you can now see him push the offense.
No, he's better defensively. He's a guy that he's not a liability on the ice defensively. You can play him against other teams' top lines, whereas some guys that are purely offensive, you just can't do that. I mean, it's just giving up a chance to get a chance the whole time. But he's a guy who cares about his own end and can play solid defensively and, like I said, can match up against other teams' top lines.
He is right now the front runner for the Norris. I don't think there's any question about that. He's going to be a guy who's tough to catch. Cale Makar is probably going to find a way into the discussion with the way he's going right now, which is remarkable he would even be in the discussion as a rookie. Drew Doughty came out last year. You heard it. He blasted some of his other peers, guys like Brent Burns, saying, well, that guy doesn't play defense. Yeah, the point total is nice, but he was a big proponent of what Mark Giordano did last year because he plays at both ends. From a player's point of view, Mo, when it comes to the Norris Trophy, how do you balance the two, and should there be more balance? Because we quite often look at the guys who are the highest scorers first.
Yeah, and that's the trick that I've actually thought they should maybe even think about introducing another trophy, like the top offensive D-man and the best defensive D-man. You know, because let's be honest, the guys who seem to get the most attention, whether you're a forward or a defenseman, are the guys that put up the larger numbers. I mean, that's just the way it's been. That's the way it's always been. And then I think if it's tight as far as the amount of points that a D-man's getting, then they factor in, okay, who's a better defenseman defensively? And I think that kind of is the tiebreaker, if you will.
In conversation with Brendan Morrison this morning on the Scott Rintoul Show, Jack Eichel starts his Western Canadian tour in Calgary tonight. Is he the most underappreciated player in the league? Who is it for you?
Oh, man. I mean, Eichel's having a great season. There's no question. You know, I think he's becoming a more well-rounded player. I have watched him in the past, and I thought at times he could be a little bit lazy. not really committed to, again, playing a two-way game. But I think he's a young kid, and he's figuring that out, and he's got great numbers to start this year. I think, personally, the most underrated player in the league right now is Barkov in Florida.
You think he's still underrated?
Yeah, I do. I do think so. I think the secret is kind of getting out more and more, but I think simply because he plays in a market like Florida, there's just no exposure. I mean, when was the last time you saw a Florida hockey game on TV? I can't even tell you. I mean, you never see him. You don't see him on TV, but the players in the league know how good he is. And I think people that are in tune with the game on a daily basis appreciate that. But I think for the common or the average fan, they don't know how good he is. I think he's the most underrated.
Yeah, and maybe it's because he got the Lady Bing last year and because he was a finalist for the Selke and he had 96 points that I feel like he is appreciated enough. But you make very good points. I wonder if the guy on that team who's underappreciated more is Jonathan Huberdeau because he now plays in Barkov's shadow.
Well, I mean, he's having a good season as well. I've always found that's kind of the issue, I guess, or when you play in a smaller market team, or even when you play out west, I find you just don't get as much attention as you do when you play in the east. Simply because a lot of times when the games in the west are on, I mean, people out east are in bed. And I found that when we played in Vancouver with the teams I was on in the early 2000s, like I think Marcus Naslund never got the due he deserved. Obviously, he did out in Vancouver. But a lot of times when you're talking to people about, who are the greatest, the Swedish hockey players to ever play, well, obviously you have Lidstrom, you have Forsberg. People talk about, Sundin, the Sedin brothers, Alfredsson. A lot of times Nazi's not in that conversation. And for the life of me, I can't understand why.
And so a guy you just left off that list, not intentionally, but I think might be the most underappreciated player of his generation, also happens to be Swedish, Nicklas Backstrom. Is that fair?
Yeah. Again, another guy who can, I was fortunate to play with him as well in Washington. And just a very high hockey IQ, good all over the ice. He can play both ends of the rink. He's reliable and early in his career, it's just been a perfect fit for him and Obi. I know Kuznetsov has kind of taken over that role now playing with Obi. But, they had a lot of great years together.
Yeah, they certainly did. I don't know if it's Backstrom or Naslund or somebody else. Who's the most underappreciated player of your era?
Well, I mentioned Nazi there, but a couple other guys that come to mind is, one guy who I played with in New Jersey was Patrick Eliash. And, I know Jersey retired his number here a couple years ago. But, here's a guy that scored 400 goals, had over 600 assists, over 1,000 points, won the Stanley Cup, has remarkable playoff numbers. Don't really hear too much about him in conversations of elite players, but I think he's right there. And a guy that maybe, is in the conversation a bit, but I think should be in there more, would be a defenseman, Sergei Zubov.
That's a good call. I mean, it was so long before they gave him the Hall of Fame nod.
Yeah, and you talk to guys that played against him. I mean, they can't say enough things about him as a hockey player and just, the patience he had with the puck and his decision-making. And, yeah, I mean, he was a phenomenal player.
Brendan Morrison joins me this morning, former Vancouver Canuck, former Calgary Flame. He does this every single Thursday with us. As mentioned, the Flames hosting the Buffalo Sabres tonight. Jack Eichel in town. Flames, the results have been there lately, even if the overall 60-minute effort necessarily hasn't been. It's been a tough couple of weeks. We talked about that last week, Mo, for this organization with everything they're dealing with Bill Peters. They got a little chance to breathe this week. They had the break. Now they get back at it. What do you think the biggest challenge for Jeff Ward is as the interim coach?
Well, I need his top guys to buy in. I mean, that's the bottom line. I mean, the reason why they haven't been winning as many games this year as last year is the production coming from their top guys. I mean, that's, I'm not trying to be harsh or critical. I mean, it's reality. I mean, that's what these guys are paid to do. And I understand that there's times throughout the season where you're going to have some ebbs and flows, right? Peaks and valleys a bit here and there. But on a consistent basis, they need to be the guys night in and night out. And so far, they really haven't been. They've had good goaltending this year. Like, that hasn't been an issue. I think coming into the season, there were some question marks about Riddick and could he handle the load and how would Talbot play in? And I feel bad for Talbot, to be honest. I think he's come in and played well so far, but he hasn't had any support at all when he's been in net. So their top-end guys got to be the guys that are there on a more consistent basis.
You'd never want to go through that as an organization. You would never choose it. That being said, they did go through it. Is it possible that the shakeup that was kind of out of their hands, it's not something that was on their watch, but the fact that they had to make a shakeup, is it possible it galvanizes this team?
Yeah, I think it can go two ways. I mean, it can negatively affect the team or it can kind of galvanize the group. And I think, time will tell here, but it looks like they've responded pretty well right off the bat. I think it's going to galvanize this group. I do. I think they have a good team. I like their makeup. I like their leadership group there with Giordano leading the way. And they have some high end talent. There's no question about it. And I think this is going to make them a stronger team. Some adversity at times. I mean, as horrible as this situation was across the board, I think these guys are going to get through it.
In Vancouver, they're also on one of those mini breaks. Don't play till Saturday. Buffalo, the next competition for them, it's an afternoon game on Saturday. They just came off a win over the Ottawa Senators. They were great in the first period after honoring Alex Burrows, and then they kind of took the foot off the gas. They were no good in the second, but the bottom line is they won. They got a 5-2 win. Travis Green took the tactic of not really holding his team's feet to the fire after that game. I thought it was the right one. I think there's certain times to be hard on your team and to be critical, and there's other times where you just have to back off. Do you agree with that it was the right time?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, at the end of the day, they did what they had to do. It was a big night, a lot of emotion there. Some guys, overlapped with Burr and a special night for him. And the team wants to come out and put on a good show and win that game, not only for him and all the fans, etc. But they got off to a good start, had the lead there, and it's a game face that they should win at the end of the day. But it's easier said than done nowadays with the parity in the league, right? I mean, gone are the days when you were on a very good team, half your guys could show up and you could win the game. Now you need everybody on a nightly basis. I mean, there's too many good teams in the league. But I think Vancouver, I mean, their power play has been very good. That really energizes that group. You know, when your power play is going, your offensive guys go. I mean, that's the time where you get touches. That's the time where you get to get into the game. And so far, their power play has been very good, and it helped them again in that game.
You mentioned that you played with John Carlson early in his career, and you might not have predicted what you're seeing right now, even though you knew he was a good player. When did you know Alex Burrows was going to be a player who could stick in the NHL?
Well, you know, I can almost remember the first practice he came out and you hear guys getting called up. And so you kind of do a little research and you find out that, you know, he started in the East Coast League and he worked his way up into the AHL. And now he's getting a chance here in the NHL. At first it's like, geez, the first thing you notice is his work ethic, really. I mean, you come into a new situation, you're a little bit uncomfortable, you're trying to fit in with the guys, but, you know, his work ethic never wavered from day one, and he improved immensely from his first practice and to where he finished his career there in Vancouver and became such an integral part of their team and the culture there, he was annoying to play against, I'll tell you that. Like, even when I played against him later in my career, but he's a guy you'd love to have on your team. And I think the one thing with Burr is that, his offensive game was underrated. He continued to get better and better. And obviously was put in a good situation there with Daniel Henrik. But, you know, he fit in. And everybody's, a lot of people always say, oh, you play with, a high-end offensive player. You know, it makes everything so much easier. Well, a lot of times it doesn't. I mean, you have to have the hockey IQ to think alike and think similarly. And some guys can do it and some guys can't do it. And, you know, he proved that he could. And what a special career he had.
Okay, one last quick one on Alex Burrows. You mentioned that the work ethic. You and I both know that the higher levels, practice comes around and there is this fine line to toe. Guys want to see effort, but there's always those guys that players roll their eyes at. Come on, man. Don't make the rest of us look bad. So how do you find that balance, and when does it become appreciated as opposed to players saying, man, just settle down a little. We're practicing.
Well, I think certain guys, it's just in them and you can't take it out of them. That's what makes them successful. I had a teammate like that when I first noticed that when I actually went to Michigan my freshman year, a teammate of mine, Blake Sloan, who went on to play with the Dallas Stars and won a Stanley Cup there. And there's no off switch. Like in practice, it's down blocking shots. It's finishing checks. And the first couple of times you're like, Jesus, man, like, we don't need to hurt each other out here. But then, then you come to really appreciate it. You know what? Like, hey, when I go against that guy, I better be ready and I better be ready to compete. I better be ready to battle. And at the end of the day, it's going to make me a better player. So you really do appreciate it.
Mo, we appreciate it when you take the time with us. We'll do it again next Thursday. Thank you very much, sir. Enjoy the hockey tonight.
Yeah, man. Sounds good. Enjoy the day.
Will do. That's Brendan Morrison, former Vancouver Canuck, former Calgary Flame. And you see him on television as well as he continues to hop and skip about to find fish. That's what he does. Real West Coast fishing. Brendan Morrison's a part of that. Obviously still involved very much in hockey. People don't necessarily know that. You get to the higher levels of sport, and hey, you want them to practice hard. You want them to give their effort. Some guys don't like that too much. Some guys say, save it for the game a little. There's this balance to be struck. But as Brendan Morrison just pointed out, there's certain guys, and Alex Burrows is one of them, and there's players like this on a lot of teams around the NHL. It's just how they are. That's how they're wired. They only know one speed, and so that's the speed they go. And if it's genuine, if it's not just, oh, I'm going to just try to impress the coach today because my teammates are fatigued, when it's genuine, players appreciate it. And guys know. Guys can tell. Good stuff with Brendan Morrison, Laurent Duvernay-Tardif. It was a very busy hour. We'll send you right now to Hockey Central in Calgary. Here in Vancouver, we'll get back to talking Canucks and why I can have a little version of I told you so today. You can laugh at me if you want, but I told you so. I told you yesterday, and I'll explain next on the Scott Rintoul Show.
This is the Scott Rintoul Show.
Besser shoots and scores right off the draw. First career NHL goal, Quinn Hughes.
On the official home of the Canucks.
And it's Markstrom again, this time with the glove.
It is Pettersson, and shoots, scores!
Sportsnet 650.
That's the type of thing you could get upset about. That's the type of thing you could get upset about as a Canucks fan if that happened to you. This is what I was trying to tell you yesterday. And it's something we'll discuss on Canucks Central today as well. Thank you for joining me. This is the Scott Rintoul Show. Ed Hervey, general manager of the BC Lions, going to join me later this hour. It's been a busy week. It's been an unsettling year for the BC Lions. Ed Hervey has had a lot of questions asked of him. I'll throw a few more his way later on this hour. We'll also get back into the conversation. That's what it's been hashtagged on Hockey Night in Canada. I think it's a smart thing to do. The conversation around hockey. Robin Lehner, if you have not heard his comments and the discussion that should ensue as a result, I think you need to. I think it's an important part of the conversation that we're having. But last night, what happened in Edmonton, that's what you could be upset about if you're a Vancouver Canucks fan. Not the way they went about getting their 5-2 win over the Ottawa Senators on Tuesday. Best effort of the season? Nope. Might be their best first period, but not their best effort. And there were some people yesterday who were hand-wringing, say, come on, it's Ottawa. You got to put them away. Play a full 60. Sometimes you don't have a full 60. And sometimes, and this is the point I was trying to make to you yesterday, there are times in an NHL season where it is more about just the result. Most of the time, it's about the process. and how you're getting the results you're getting, why you're not getting the good ones, why you're finding a way through in those tough settings. But on Tuesday, when you've played 8 games in 15 days and you're just back from what was a 6-game road trip that probably felt like 7 because you played back-to-back in Edmonton and home on the weekend, and you're still trying to get the jet lag out of you and you're still trying to figure out exactly where you're at and get re-immersed in your own home, your family, all of those things, sometimes you don't have 60 minutes. And the important thing on Tuesday was just getting the W, making sure that a team you should beat gets beaten. Edmonton found out the hard way last night. Edmonton found out that if you don't get a couple of saves and you don't bring a decent enough game for long enough, even the Ottawa Senators, a team languishing near the bottom of the standings, can sting you. And they did the rest of the West a favor yesterday. So hats off to the Ottawa Senators. That's a team that's playing its third game on the Western road swing, and I know they got a break between Calgary and Vancouver on Tuesday, but back-to-back nights, they had to go to Vancouver, they had to go to Edmonton, but they did in Edmonton what they did in Vancouver. They just kept working hard. They're not great. They're not good. They don't have enough talent on that roster. But they'll work hard, and if you don't show up at all, you'll get beaten. So that's what happened to the Oilers last night. That's what you should be upset about if you're a Canucks fan, not a 5-2 win that didn't necessarily feel like a 5-2 win. Bottom line, they got the points. There'll be plenty of other games where you can critique the 60 minutes and, hey, I'm a little bit worried about this trend I've seen developing over the last number of games. Fair enough. Fair enough. But that wasn't the night on Tuesday. Canucks have a nice break now. They had day off yesterday, day off today. Travis Green will get them back at it tomorrow. And then it's an afternoon game against the Buffalo Sabres, 1 o'clock, Rogers Arena. One of the conversations we've been having this morning is about most underrated players, most underappreciated players in the NHL, because when the Canucks take to the ice again, they're going to do so against Jack Eichel. Another great start to the season, had an excellent year offensively last year, but it kind of gets lost because his team was no good. And that has been the story for Jack Eichel his entire career. The team's been no good in Buffalo. So you discount his own individual statistics. Last year was a breakout year of sorts. He was a point-of-game guy. But the Sabres suck. Had this text in from Tanbeer. Jack Eichel reminds me of MacKinnon when he was playing on the bad Colorado teams. That's fair. MacKinnon had the great rookie season, then a couple of steps back, which is why he's on such a sweetheart deal. Did you hear what he said today, by the way? Said he would take less next time as well. A lot of people have said, boy, I don't know. I don't know how Nathan MacKinnon feels about that contract. Man, $6.3 million. Sure, it's a lot of money, but that guy could be making double that. MacKinnon says, you know what? Next contract, if it means we're good, I'll take less again. That's the kind of guy I want on my hockey team. If I'm a fan, if I'm an agent, I'm saying, no, you hold out for best dollar. If I'm the NHLPA, you say, no, you hold out for best dollar. But if I'm a fan, if I'm a teammate, if I'm a GM, that is my dream come true, that I have a guy of that caliber who will be willing to take less. Back to the Jack Eichel discussion. Is he the most underrated player in the league? Is he most underappreciated player in the league? It's a conversation we can have. Get in. You've got the Subway text line, 650-650. Somebody suggested John Carlson earlier today. He may still be underappreciated. I'm not sure. But we've talked about him a decent amount this year. He was leading the NHL in scoring when he had 20 points. Got there before anybody else this year. So he got a bit of run. And then McDavid and Drysdale and a couple others passed him. And Carlson's doing nice. Yeah, he's leading defenseman. People didn't pay attention about him. I don't know if it was just a couple of weeks. I don't know if it was a month. It died down a little. Well, it's back up. At least it's certainly back up for me as far as attention goes for John Carlson. Dude scored 2 goals again last night. He has 42 points in 30 games. Do the math on that. Do the math on 42 points in 30 games. John Carlson right now on pace for a 100-point season. Chances are that pace slows down. But even if it does, even if that pace slows down, John Carlson is more than halfway to the best blue line production we've seen from any player since the turn of the century. Brent Burns had 83 points last year. That's the most since we got into the 2000s. If he hits 90 points this year, as in John Carlson, it'll be the first time since 93-94 anybody has hit that. Ray Bourque is the last guy to do it. The last defense. Eric Carlson hasn't done that. Eric Carlson had an 82-point year, and it came before these last couple where goal scoring is up. It was a remarkable season. I take zero away from him. 82 points in 82 games as a defenseman? Amazing. John Carlson might have 50 points by Christmas. If you're a Canucks fan, you know what that marker means. If you're a Canucks fan, you realize that Christian Ehrhoff is the only defenseman to have 50 points this century. One guy, and he got 250 on the nose, and John Carlson might have that many by Christmas. Now, I think Quinn Hughes is going past 50 this year as well. Great revelation, I know, after his start. So he's going to surpass that too. Scoring is up. We see a different level of blue liner right now and a different style of game right now. But 50 points by Christmas? Guys, Christian Ehrhoff had 50 points in the Canucks' greatest season ever. And John Carlson might get there by the time he's unwrapping presents. And he doesn't have to be crazy out of this world to do it either, compared to what he's been doing. He has to be a point-a-game guy. They have 8 games. You do the math. He gets 8 points in those games. He has 50 by Christmas. He's the front-runner for the Norris. Yes, there's a lot around Cale Makar, and yes, he's going to be in the conversation if he keeps playing this way, but nobody's touching Carlson if this keeps up. Nobody's coming close. It's going to be a slam dunk. Bobby texts in, says, John Carlson better than Eric Carlson. Well, certainly this year, career-wise, I'm not sure I'd go there. Now, he does have a cup. Eric Carlson does not have one of those. John Carlson likely to get himself a Norris Trophy if this continues. And okay, now we're talking the same conversation. I do believe Eric Carlson. I think Eric Carlson's defense has been underrated for the bulk of his career. I think people looked at the point total. I think there were people who assumed that he couldn't play defense at all. And while, yeah, the offensive gifts are greater than the defensive ones, I don't think I'd put him in the same category as a Mike Green. Mike Green, as Brendan Morrison just told us in the last half an hour, he was a great offensive defenseman, but he had his limitations in his own end. Wasn't as interested in playing back there, wasn't as talented playing back there. Eric Carlson's better than that. But that'll be a conversation in the next few years if John Carlson continues to be prominent. Which Carlson is better? You want to weigh on that? You can. You've got the Subway text line. I'm Scott Rintoul. I promised you some Robin Lehner audio. I want to get to this. The conversation about coaches, about players, about communication, about where we are and how we coach and what the right way to do things continues. Robin Lehner said something that you have not heard a lot of people in the hockey world say. I think you've heard fans say it. I think perhaps you've heard some media members say it. You have not heard many in the hockey world go down this road. Robin Lehner yesterday in an extended conversation with The Athletic, that's when it was posted, Mark Lazarus in Chicago, he posted this interview. He also detailed it for you. He transcribed it so you can read it as well. And it's great. Robin Lehner has an opinion that is counter to the main one that's out there right now about coaching, about guys losing their jobs, about where we're at in this discussion. Have a listen.
I believe everyone deserves a second chance, even if they've been bad people. I've been a bad person. Carcillo, who leads this charge right now, he's been a bad person. And now he gets to cancel people out. Now he gets to cancel because he's done his career and he's finally doing good. I really commend him for ending the cycle of abuse, what he's done now. It doesn't mean that he gets to... He and that whole movement and cancel culture in general gets to destroy these people's lives without a fair process and an opportunity to change. Why do you have to lose your whole life? Why do you have to lose everything to be able to come back? Because you can't come back after that. Don't tell me that Peters is going to be back in the league.
And let's put it this way. If you read the article, you will realize that Robin Lehner is not condoning what Bill Peters did. Not at all. And in fact, Lehner says, pointing the arc, he said, I don't even like Bill Peters because of what he did to Eddie Lack. And that's nowhere near what we're talking about with Hakeem Alioune. A couple of things there. Fair process. Cancel culture. Lose your whole life. Second chance. Those are some of the buzzwords in that clip. And it's an extended interview. I don't think it does complete justice to what Lehner is saying, but you get an idea of where he's going. He's saying that the cancel culture, which is a buzz term that a lot of people are using right now, and they blanket it. The cancel culture, it's not fair to these people. Are they evil people? Are they really bad people? Or are they good people who've done bad things? And I think that's a good way to look at this conversation. I don't know Bill Peters. I can't tell you if he's a bad guy. I can't. I know he's done some bad things. And that's Lehner's point. And Lehner said, I've done some bad things. I got a second chance. Should I have not been allowed a second chance? There are layers to this. Cancel culture suggests that everything is taken away from you. You're unemployable. Everything in your life gets turned upside down. To some extent, that's happened for Bill Peters. But I have certainly been an advocate of this, and I think there are a lot of people who agree with this. Okay, you made a mistake. There are consequences for it. In Bill Peters' case, the consequence is you're not the head coach of the Calgary Flames anymore. Is there a second chance? If you earn it, I think there should be. I agree with that wholeheartedly. There are certain transgressions in life that if you go beyond those thresholds, if you murder someone, well, guess what? There's going to be a big price, and you're going to have to pay major consequences before you're afforded a second chance. And depending how bad your transgressions were in that case, you might not get a second chance. I used this example earlier. I'll use it again. Graham James, I don't think deserves a second chance to coach hockey. I know that happened. There's a guy I don't ever want around kids again because of what he did. He can have chances in other areas of society, but not that one. That's my opinion. I think a lot of people would agree with that. When you get the second chance, when you go through education, when you go through rehabilitation, are you entitled to do it at the same level you were at before? That's what's at the heart of that conversation for me, that Robin Lehner has brought up. Should Bill Peters be educated? Yes. Rehabilitated in his attitudes, if that's what really needs to change. Yes. Does that mean he gets to step in as a head coach of an NHL team right away? No. Maybe it does, but maybe the next opportunity is at a lower level. Maybe the next opportunity is at a minor hockey league level. Maybe he needs to be an advocate. Your second chance doesn't always come at the exact same jumping off point. Robin Lehner's didn't. Robin Lehner wasn't installed as a number one starter. It's your job. Go run with it. That was his billing. As far as talent goes, when he was selected, that's what Ottawa thought he was going to be. So his second chance, he had to earn the second chance to be that guy. And he's made the most of it. I applaud him for that. He put in the work. And he talks about it. He's an advocate of mental illness, mental health, and the ongoing education in those regards. And I think he's on the right track there. I support everything he's doing in that capacity. But your second chance doesn't necessarily come where your first chance ended. Langley Fun Guy says this, I really applaud Lehner for his recent viral statements. He's a polarizer figure right now, and this coach's under fire fight isn't his, but his beliefs are humane and wholesome, and I agree that people grow experience by experience. To say Peters and Crawford haven't grown and matured since their incidents is naive and unfair. If we all look in the mirror and ask ourselves, have we changed in the past 10 years? The answer is almost always yes. Lehner's a fantastic spokesperson at the moment for the NHL, in need of more players like that on the platform. That's from Langley Fun Guy. We can't assume that behavior gets better over those 10 years. Langley Fun Guy might be right. I would hope that Bill Peters has matured and become a better person over 10 years, but we also can't just make that assumption. I would assume, or I shouldn't say assume, I would hope that Mark Crawford has done the same. But we can't just make that assumption. There is an investigation, and the consequences aren't always the same either. Mark Crawford is not alleged to have done what Bill Peters did, and so the consequences may be far less harsh. Emily Kaplan was on with the program yesterday, It's a big conversation that's going on in hockey right now. She's talked to a lot of the players. Here's what she had to say about those discussions.
I find the hockey community really divided. There's some people out there saying, this is the tip of the iceberg. You don't know what goes on in hockey culture. It's awful. There's a culture of silence. It's all going to come out. And then there's another school of people, and these are a lot of veteran players that I've talked to in the league that were like, look, I think these are some isolated incidents. And obviously we have an issue with race in this league, and we need to address that, especially in our sport. But as it pertains to coaching abuse, like, I think we've evolved, and I think it's a little grand to say that this is, you know, as a sweeping of a scandal as it is. Honestly, when things do come out, I think more will come out, but I think it's going to be more on the junior levels, and we're going to hear some bad stories about coaches there, not necessarily at the NHL level.
A lot of people would agree with that. I'm not sure where the stories go, but I think that a lot of people would agree with that. Joey from Richmond sends this in. For me, the crux of the coaching situation is reparations. How are these guys going to make good by the guys they wronged? Coaching is a job without a finite timeline. There's young coaches and old coaches. Guys like Johan Franzen, who had their lives destroyed, don't get a second shot at their careers the way coaches do. A pro athlete has a pretty specific window of what years are their prime achieving and money-making years. In some cases, the coaches have taken that away from these guys. That's where it gets murky for me, says Joey in Richmond. How do you assess appropriate punishment or resolution if that's the end game? Gray area. I don't have an answer to that. I do agree that each situation is different. And we referenced this when the Hakeem Alyu article first came out. It's a point he makes that I don't think enough people paid attention to at the time, nor do they pay attention to it now. He said at the time, I think if he had apologized, we could have moved on. You think of that. You think of the power of the apology, the resolution in the moment. If that occurs, maybe we're not talking about this in 2019. Maybe the maturation happens earlier. Maybe Alyu's career is different. Maybe he doesn't have the same resentment toward coaches and the system the way that he was really coached into. I completely understand why he feels alienated by the sport and why when opportunities didn't go the way he had hoped, he feels like there's something more in place that's systemic that doesn't have anything to do with hockey. Whether that's true or not, I completely understand why he feels that way. The power of the resolution and the timeliness of the resolution. You can agree with whether it was done properly or not, but Brian Burke came on our station today and he again referenced the Brent Sopel, Mark Crawford situation. He said, during my entire time with Mark Crawford, I saw a guy do something once, and it was when he kicked Brent Sopel, and I dealt with it in this manner. I made him apologize to Sopel personally. I made him apologize in front of the team, and I told him unequivocally if it ever happened again with any player, he was gone. Now, I don't know if that was enough for Brent Sopel. I don't know if he agrees with that. That's part of this. Is there a satisfaction on the side of the party that's been offended? That's a part of this discussion as well. But we will continue to hear these conversations. I thought it was really great that Robin Lehner put that conversation out there. Whether you agree with everything he had to say or not, there are multiple sides to this, and there are multiple conversations to be had. Scott Rintoul with you, general manager of the BC Lions, coming up just after the bottom of the hour. I wanted to sneak this in. Laurent Duvernay-Tardif joined the program earlier, starting offensive lineman with the Kansas City Chiefs. Big games going on this weekend. Not sure if you consider Dallas at Chicago one of those tonight. Doesn't exactly have the same pop as New England hosting Kansas City, but I digress. We asked him about his coach. Everybody's going to talk about Bill Belichick in this game. Andy Reid, what makes him such a good coach to play for?
I mean, Coach Reid is just the ultimate team player. You know, he wants to put you as an individual and collectively in the best position to make plays, and that's what he's known for. And he's been able to like design play to really take advantage of our strength and the defense weakness over the last years. And it's really great to play for a coach like that really gives you an opportunity to show what you can do, and that really wants you to show your personality on the field and play with that swagger.
Do you guys feel overlooked at all this year? Laurent, because people are talking Ravens. Obviously, the Patriots get some run. Do you guys feel overlooked?
No, I mean, I think we're right where we want to be. And at the end of the day, it's not a matter of like how you start or how the year goes. It's how you finish that last quarter of the season. It's December football. It's cold. It's nice out, and that's it's for those kind of moments that you prepare, that you want to play for, getting ready for the playoffs.
You mentioned what Andy Reid does and how he utilizes the weapons. Well, you guys have a lot of weapons. I could ask you about so many of them, but let's go with Travis Kelce. He's on the verge of some NFL history. If he gets to 1,000 yards, which he likely will, he'd be the first guy ever to have four consecutive 1,000-yard receiving seasons as a tight end. He's part pass catcher. He's part lineman. From an O-lineman's point of view, what impresses you about Travis Kelce's skill set?
I mean, you got to respect the guy. He's an awesome team player, and the way he's able to like get open and run his route, you know, it's not always like the most explosive route, but he's always able to get open, always able to give a little like head fake to beat man coverage and get open, and he's also a tremendous blocker. You know, we have a lot of play where we put him one on one versus the DN, and he's able to lock these guys down. So he's a great all around player, and of course as an offensive lineman you look for those stats and those catches, but you also really respect the ability to block in the run game, and that's what he's been able to do so well.
We will detail the Chiefs Patriots matchup more tomorrow, but we're going to find out a lot about the New England Patriots this weekend. Normally we look at this as the litmus test for a team like the Chiefs. I think we had a pretty good idea what the Chiefs are. The only thing really you want to know about Kansas City, in my opinion, is their defense a little underrated. Can it get better than we assume it's been for most of the season? That's my only question about the Chiefs. I know what that offense is capable of doing. I know what Patrick Mahomes can do, and I've seen him now do it in the playoffs. The New England Patriots, can they get a little bit right offensively? That's my big question going into that game. Yeah, Belichick's going to coach up the D. But if you are one of those, and I think there's a lot of these around here, if you are one of those people who have said, okay, finally, it's the year. It's the year where it all starts to come undone. It's the year where they're not the evil empire dominant superpower. This is finally the year. If you're one of those people, you see New England lose this weekend, you're going to have a little more evidence. You see that offense have trouble moving the football, you're going to have a little more evidence. I think this game is more about finding out what New England is than finding out what Kansas City is. Agree, disagree? Let's have a debate. Subway text line 650-650. What's the biggest challenge for the BC Lions in 2020? And does Ed Hervey expect this team to be sold? Find out next when the general manager joins me right here on your home of Canucks Hockey, Sportsnet 650.
Now more of the Scott Rintoul Show on the official home of the Canucks, Sportsnet 650.
The Lions and the CFL have to engage new fans. The season ticket holders are dropping like flies in Toronto and Vancouver. David Braley has to stop the bleeding or sell. That is from Duncan. That came in during the course of our break. You're not wrong. That's fair, and that is one of the challenges the BC Lions have. I'm not sure it's one that Ed Hervey is in charge of. You can make that determination for yourself. How much is the general manager in charge of that? How much does that fall on the president, the owner, everybody else in the organization? It's a big job. It's a really big job. Ed Hervey, his main priority, getting his football team set for next season. He's got his coach in place. Is Jason Moss coming to town? Let's find out. General Manager of the BC Lions, Ed Hervey, joins me now. Ed, thank you very much for taking the time. How are you?
I'm doing well. No problem. Glad to be on.
It's been a busy week for you. Looking back over the last 12 months, this last calendar year, how would you assess these last 12 months in BC that have led to you hiring Rick Campbell this week?
I think the last 12 months, I think, well, obviously we didn't, you know, meet our expectation, and we had, you know, various reasons for that. But at the end of the day, when we assess it and when I had to look at it deeply, it was a question of whether or not we could have success moving forward. And it's not putting placing the, you know, the blame on one person. It's just the entire operation, everything that was going on the field, off the field, just all of it. And, you know, at the end of it, it was in our best interest to make a change. And you know, couldn't be more happy to have Rick Campbell join us. I think that he will, you know, bring a lot of what we need and expect, you know, in that department. And then, you know, everyone else in the department needs to catch up and also, you know, fulfill their job priorities and responsibilities, and let's have a successful year moving forward.
You went through this process of hiring a head coach in Edmonton. You've had to go through it a couple of times here in BC. What did this last year teach you about that process?
Experience is extremely vital. Is one lesson to be taught. You know, again, there's always the unknown when you're reaching out and bringing new people on, and times it works, and at times it takes a little time to get going, and sometimes it's just, you know, for whatever reason, it doesn't work out as you hoped and planned. And then when you start really looking at everything, it becomes a bit overwhelming in areas that you just don't see it getting any better. And for myself, on a personal level, looking at, you know, the changes that needed to be made and required, there comes a point at in this process where, you know, you give, you know, people have gotten their first opportunities and most have made the most of it. But, you know, to have an opportunity to work with a coach who has experience. And again, I've worked with Wally, which is different. I've came in, he hired me and brought me in, but having an opportunity to put my own stamp on the coaching staff, and, you know, this time taking the chance with experience and bringing experienced staff and surrounding it with that, I think that's going to play well in our favor. Just in the little things, the things that people don't see, you know, the stuff that doesn't hit the field. And those are the areas where I think this hire is going to be most beneficial to our organization.
The hire, of course, is Rick Campbell. That happened this week. Ed Hervey's the man who hired him. He's the general manager of the BC Lions. He joins us here this morning on Sportsnet 650. There were other opportunities out there. Rick Campbell was in demand. How much did you have to sell him on the opportunity here in BC?
Honestly, I didn't. It wasn't much of a sale job, to be openly honest. You know, I mean, I've known Rick a long time. What's there not to like about Vancouver? I mean, our weather's better than all the other places. There's so much to do here away from football. When you look at what we have on the field, you know, we have a franchise quarterback, which is always appealing to any coach. We have quality depth in our Canadians. We have a big play receiver in Brian Burnham. We have skill guys on the back end. And when we talked, you know, when we talked about areas that needed to be upgraded, the task wasn't as daunting as most would think. And I felt that, you know, as far as me explaining our roster and showing our organization and showing everything that we have, I thought it was intriguing for any coach. And when Rick and I had an opportunity to speak on it, he felt the same way, and he was, you know, he was excited about the opportunity of working here and joining us. And I mean, again, you could hear it in his voice how excited he was about the opportunity. And for me, it was good and felt good to know that he wanted to be a part of what we're building here. And I believe that we're going to have real success because of the details, more than anything, will be a main focus of moving forward and obviously improving in other areas. But knowing that we're going to be on the same page, that's extremely important to me as well as it's important to him.
I completely understand in your position looking at the positives and wanting to focus on those and the foundation of this club moving forward, and yet we would all agree after last season there's plenty of work to be done. Ed, what do you consider the biggest challenge for this club in the coming months?
I think, really, when we look at it, we'd like to improve in our defensive line. I think that's probably area one. The ability, the previous year we were able to get a tremendous amount of pressure with the guys that we had, and we brought that group back, and they were asked to do some things differently, but it didn't work out, but we want to be more disruptive up front. We need to be more active. We need to apply more pressure, and then obviously we got to be firm against the run as well. And we can't be limited to only trying to get to the quarterback. There are other responsibilities that defensive linemen have to adhere to, and we're looking for those guys to bring in. And obviously, we would hope that our offensive line play would be improved from the jump. And I think that early on gave us we lost sleep over those areas, and just trying to improve our team at the line of scrimmage, I think, is the main priority for us. And then, as I said, there in other areas, and just making sure that we're able to, find the kind of players that fit what the coaches are expecting those players to do, and making sure that the personnel department and the coaches are all on the same page as far as that's concerned. And I put that responsibility on myself to ensure that is seen as a top priority moving forward. I believe that we have a very good core of guys here. I feel like we have a good nucleus. And from last season to this season, if you look at where we were this time last year, we didn't know who our quarterback was going to be. We didn't have an idea of what our core was going to be. And going into free agency, we were able to sign players from other teams that were all stars on other teams, but they never had a chance to go through games together and battle together. And listening to the players in the exit medicals and exit meetings, all the players are excited about next year, and they feel like they found their roles within the team, which was something that they would admit it took them some time to figure out.
We know Mike Riley can get it done. Even though last year was a down year, he would admit he needs to be better as well. Ed, I've covered him since he broke into the CFL. You've been around him a long time. Last year is the first time in his entire career, despite that tough year you guys both went through in Edmonton, last year is the first time I saw resignation on the face and the body language of Mike Riley. What was at the heart of that, in your opinion?
Well, I think what people don't realize is Mike was also sick. I have to commend Mike, and I'm not going to get into the details of it, but he was battling some other stuff that I would imagine that would have kept most players out of games, and he was able to battle through that. As far as the physical component, I would imagine that any player, when you're getting beat up like he was this past year, would take its toll, and I know it took its toll on him. And he hung in there, he never complained, but again, body language and all that stuff, people try to read into. I thought he was more positive than what people were trying to lead on. But again, you can see it. It was the wear and tear was starting to take its toll on him. But I would also say that he showed a great deal of toughness overcoming some other stuff that I'm certain that most players would just have thrown in the towel and decided to, sit out the rest of the season for. So, I have to commend him on that and look forward to a stronger season next year, and the excitement that the new staff will bring, and with hopes of our fans seeing the Mike Riley that we expect to see and the offense that we expect to see coming out the gate.
Will that new staff include Jason Moss as an offensive coordinator?
I think with Jason. Jason has plenty of opportunity. You have to understand Jason. Jason is, you know, I think people are just assuming that Jay is going to come here because it's like putting the band back together because we've all been friends. You know, Jason is a family man first. And I know Jay. Jay's going to look at cost of living in Vancouver. He's going to look at convenience to staying with his family, how close it is to his family. Jay is his own man. And I think people are, you know, expecting Jay to come out here for all the reasons. I believe that Jay is going to take a long, hard look at other options. And he's going to make his decision based on what is best for his family. And, you know, and with that said, I mean, I wouldn't be surprised if he did go elsewhere, you know, based on that, because, you know, again, primarily when you know, I've had conversations with him, and the biggest apprehension that most people have about Vancouver is the cost of living, and, you know, being in the cap world, it's different. Right. So, you know, I would say, you know, is it 50-50? I would say it's less than 50-50 that we get him here.
Fair enough. I'm not sure what you would handicap the odds of this team being sold at, but David Braley has said he wants to do it. We've heard the commissioner talk about it. Ed, are you expecting the Lions to be sold in the near future?
Well, I mean, those are questions I leave for Rick Lalisher, our president. You know, my primary focus is ensuring that we're able to put a good football team on the field and surround ourselves with the right people and have a rebound from last year's disappointment. I'm excited about our team, excited about the Lions, and I would imagine that anyone who looks at this team, looks at this organization, and someone who's passionate about the CFL would be interested in this team. But as it sits right now, those are conversations that I don't necessarily speak on, because there's so many things happening in my world with the coaching staff and the players that it would be out of my position to speak on that, because there's things that are happening that I'm not aware of as I'm doing my job.
Maybe this falls there as well, Ed, but you and I both know there's no simple answer in this community to just putting more butts in seats all of a sudden at BC Place. You've been here a couple of years now. What do you consider the biggest obstacle to making that happen?
Well, I mean, like it is, again, this isn't my answer. This is just talking with fans, asking questions of whenever I'm out and they'll see, you know, that the vehicle, or see the logo on the truck, and they'll come and have a quick conversation, and I'll ask people, do they go to the games? Have they been to the games? And they'll tell me how passionate they are about the BC Lions. They'll say how much they love the BC Lions, but they haven't gone to a game in, you know, 5, 6, 7, 8 years. And they say it's too expensive to park, or they, you know, when they leave downtown, they don't want to go back. There's a whole lot of reasons why people don't go. I don't know the other reasons. Some people say there's a disconnect between the community and the team, which I find that hard to believe, because I think our community program does an excellent job keeping our players in the community and keeping fans engaged and working with those who follow the team. I just find that it's a little different out here in Vancouver, because people have so many different things to do. I think there's so many options. You see a lot of people driving down to the Seahawks games and stuff, but you know, the CFL is still relevant in my opinion, and I still feel that it's a great value for fans and people to come and watch. And if we're going to be compared to the NFL, I don't believe the NFL can be compared to, you know, anything. I don't think you can compare to the NFL and college ball. I think every game and every they're different. They're different games, but I would hope that fans would see the value in the CFL and recognize that these are players that are coming up here for their entertainment and get back to buying into it. But there's no one answer for the reason why fans are, you know, not there, outside of we have to do our part as far as giving them a winning product. But I'm not sure that that's the only answer in this market.
Yeah, I would agree. It's a complex one, and I hope you're right. I hope people get back in that building. I hope you're able to restore the roar in the very near future. Ed, thank you very much for your time this morning. Let's do this again soon.
I appreciate your time. Thanks for having me on.
It's a long road to get back to where they were, a very long road. I did find it interesting that he says he didn't have to sell Rick Campbell on this opportunity. There were others out there, and Rick Campbell could have waited. And the one in Edmonton that is certainly one that would jump to the forefront. Because Rick Campbell's family, if you know anything about CFL history, Hugh Campbell, he's the guy who presided over multiple Eskimo championships. He's a minted man in that town. Rick Campbell's his son. Hugh Campbell's the guy who was the coach for the five in a row for the Eskimos. But I digress. Rick Campbell could have waited for that opportunity. He didn't. He took this one, which I find interesting, given some of the challenges there are in this market. Also interesting, and this came out while we were doing the interview toward the tail end, Ed Hervey saying, Jason Moss, I would say less than 50-50 that he's coming here. Sounds like he's going to Saskatchewan. Sounds like that's where Jason Moss is headed. Ed Hervey didn't want to break that for us during the course of this interview, but it doesn't sound like there will be any type of reuniting with Mike Riley here in BC. Sounds like Jason Moss is headed there. Mike Riley was dealing with something more than what we knew about last year as far as illness goes, as far as being hurt goes. Ed Hervey didn't want to get into the details of that conversation either. But yeah, this team has a long way to go. A long way to go to build itself back up. And I'm not sure what the ceiling is now. Times changed. Forever, BC Place wasn't going to put sales up for Lions games. They were going to open that upper deck, and then eventually they went the same way the Whitecaps went from the get-go and said, 27,000, if we can get that, that would be great. Well, they're a long way from getting that right now. They're a long way from 10 years ago when they were averaging over 30,000 fans a game. And maybe they don't ever get back there. Who knows? But there is a way to build it up better than what it has been. As mentioned, week 14 in the NFL gets going tonight. Dallas at Chicago. If you root for chaos, and many of us do, if you don't have a rooting interest in the Dallas Cowboys, if you don't have a rooting interest in the Chicago Bears, Seaball, by the way, in Chicago for this game tonight. Good for him. I hope he has a great time. He's off to Soldier Field. A long-suffering Bears fan. Even when they went to the Super Bowl, it was Rex Grossman who got them there. It's not like you felt really confident. So yes, he is a long-suffering Bears fan. But if you root for chaos, here's what you should root for tonight. You should root for a Bears victory, and you should root for Mitch Trubisky to play well. That's what you should root for in Chicago. Because what did we know was a fait accompli? Mitch Trubisky parting ways with the Chicago Bears. They're out on him. Needs a change of scenery. Well, if they win and he plays well, now, does your decision get any more complicated? If he has a decent month of December, do you say, well, you know what, maybe we could do... I know what Bears fans think. I know there's no chance they want him back. I know they want to move in another direction. But if you root for chaos, that's what you hope for tonight, because then that leaves Dallas 6-7 atop the NFC East still at 6-7. And you know how much chaos can ensue in Dallas. Speaking of fait accompli, Jason Garrett likely on his way out the door. Could that happen before season's end? I'm not cheering for anyone to lose his job. But if you want to see some sort of debacle in the NFC East, Dallas losing tonight at Chicago, that would really get things going. Monday night features the Philadelphia Eagles. They've got what looks like an easy schedule down the stretch, but the way Philly's playing, losing to Miami last week, you might get another division winner that is no better than 500, which I have been telling you for weeks is going to cause rise to one of the, to me, true awful situations that the NFL has to offer. This drives me nuts in sports. I have no problem if you're going to have divisions, division winners winning. Getting in the playoffs by winning their division. I have no problem with that. I have a problem with them hosting playoff games when their record sucks. And yes, that means we might never have seen the beast mode run down in Seattle, because that 7-9 team got to host the New Orleans Saints. And I don't think the Seattle Seahawks beat the Saints at the Superdome if they play down there. Breaking news. They probably don't win that game. I'm sorry, man. If you're 8-8, you shouldn't be hosting a playoff game against a team that's 12-4.
Well, it's going to be even worse this year because of the two powerhouses in the NFC West. I mean, those teams could each have 13 wins easily, and one of them will have to go on the road in the first round.
You think it's bad when the Toronto Maple Leafs and Boston Bruins have to play each other in the first round? I know people here don't think that's bad. I think people here think that's funny. But you want to hear complaints about that? Imagine that. Imagine you win 12 games, 13 games this year, and you're going on the road for a playoff game to start. Seems nuts, but that's what could happen. In fact, it's probably pretty likely to happen for either the 49ers or the Seahawks. One of those teams is going to have it happen to it. We'll talk Canucks Central next. Dan Rosen's going to join us, zip around the NHL, check in on the Taylor Hall situation. And a very prominent name is a healthy scratch tonight in the National Hockey League. We'll tell you who. We'll tell you why next on Canucks Central.